Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 14th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, both within steps of the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal and really in the heart of the ravaged nation that is America. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Mass Torts Conference 2022. It's Casual Friday, folks. I have forgotten the way to intro this show. On the program today, we'll be talking to a couple of lawyers from this Mass Torts Conference on a couple of more plaintiff cases. Also on the program today, January 6th committee votes to subpoena Trump. Secret Service apparently had at least a week's notice worth of notice of violence happening at the Capitol on January 6th. Supreme Court will stay out of the Trump stolen document fight. 15-year-old mass shooter kills five in North Carolina. Mitch McConnell rebuffs Peter Thiel. Won't match his support for Blake Masters. Meanwhile, in Florida, DeSantis' migrant stunt may end up doing some good, i.e. citizenship for those very migrants. And speaking of DeSantis, in the wake of Hurricane Ian, he changes voting rules for some counties, Republican counties, to make it easier for them to vote in the midterms. New report shows CEO pay has risen 1,500% in the past 45 years.
They're working that much harder.
Ah, but don't fret, because workers have also gotten a bump. Typical worker, 3.9%.
Ah.
Liz Truss fires her finance minister after another example of failed supply-side economics. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being here. I am in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Mass Torts Conference. First time back in 3 years. And it's been a little bit tricky to navigate, get back into the flow of things, both from a technical standpoint. I had some technical issues yesterday. Which I want to apologize for. Sorry, but not really sorry. I mean, I am sorry, but I, you know, what
the chat says there's going to be a mass tort action against us because of the audio yesterday.
Well, that's good. And if there's lawyers, maybe next year when I come, I can interview somebody who's suing me.
And someone should be suing you as well for lying to the audience about the nature of your dress. This is supposed to be Casual Friday, and yet that is the stiffest collar I've ever seen on you.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's true. However, I am not wearing my suit coat,
which it is casual. It's conference casual.
I guess it's all casual. Casualness is all contextual.
I will say this.
I'm making up a word.
You know, casualty. I think after COVID... after COVID, I'm looking around, and I think that the conference has become slightly more casual. Not significantly. We have a guest here who might be able to help us in a bit. We will get to him in a moment. The way that the flow of the conference has worked, it's been a little bit trickier to get guests than in the past. Although yesterday. Illness prevented one of our big guests from coming, and today we had some wires crossed. So we have a couple of people coming. We got a couple of cases we're going to be discussing. Really interesting cases, in some instances disturbing cases, and we will get to those. But first, we are now sort of in the midst of debate season for the 22 midterms, and we will play some debate coverage from there. But yesterday was the final. Oh, hi, Emma.
Hi.
I forgot to introduce you.
Oh,
because you just came right in and basically
with an insult.
Well, it was really more like a subpoena or like a like a notice of suit.
You've been served. Okay. I mean, and look, when in Rome, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you're in Brooklyn.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I've spoken a lot about how I wish I was there so I could gamble and have fun. So I'm living vicariously through you.
Maybe in the future.
Maybe.
And I lost my train of thought.
January 6th.
Right, January 6th had their final hearing yesterday, and they played some videos that, again, we heard some various testimony. This is interesting video. I find it weird. I have no sense, to be honest with you, how it will resonate in terms of the politics. But I think it was effective at least in getting people to think about January 6th again, which because of the hearings that had been suspended over the course of the summer, I think, had fallen in the consciousness of people. But here is footage. Do we know who took this footage?
So apparently this was Christine Pelosi. Pelosi's daughter was with her.
Right. She's a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah. This particular moment is Pelosi on the phone with Vice President Pence talking about how they can return and resume the certification process.
Yeah, and I will say this. The thing that struck me, I mean, all the people who have contacted me and talked about it, the first thing they say is, like, they don't swear. Like, it's
even in these moments,
even when Pelosi said that she wanted to punch Trump in the face at one point in this video and that she'd go to jail, which was truly one of her best moments of her career, in my opinion. It's a low bar, but I one of her only likable moments for me. She didn't swear on that either.
No, it's very odd.
I'd be freaking out.
Yeah. But all right, let's play this.
We talked to Mitch about it earlier. He's not in the room right now, but he was with us earlier and said, we want to expedite this, and hopefully they could confine it to just one complaint, Arizona, and then we could vote, and it would be, then just move forward with the rest of the state. The overriding wish is to do it at the Capitol. What we are being told very directly is it's going to take days for the Capitol to be okay again. We've gotten a very bad report about the condition of the House floor with defecation and all that kind of thing as well. I don't think that's hard to clean up, but I do think it is more from a security standpoint of making sure that everybody is out of the building, and how long will that take?
I just got off with the Vice President.
And I got off with the Vice President-elect.
All right.
What we left the conversation with, because he said he had the impression from Mitch that Mitch wanted everybody back to do it there.
Yes.
I said, well, we're getting a counterpoint that is, it could take time to clean up the poo-poo that they're making all over, literally and figuratively, in the Capitol, and that it may take days to get back.
Okay.
The poo-poo? I mean, I guess, when I do this show, I'm a little bit reluctant to swear.
But you're on air. You're broadcasting.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that it makes you wonder how conscious they were of the existence of the camera. I mean, this is something that I'm super sensitive to, just because when I was in show business and the films I made were fake documentaries, And so I watched a lot of documentaries in looking for that level of consciousness.
It's a stark contrast to say, like, how Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was hiding in her office and afraid that she was going to be sexually assaulted.
They're in a much more secure location,
yes,
right? And so I think they're off premises and they know that they're safe here. But I'm just not clear like what it was supposed to show. That, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why the timing of it now as opposed to
We picked the most like ungenerous part of the clip that we could for them, I would say, where they're acting.
And we should say at other points they're calling around, they're trying to get like there's a clip of at one point where they are speaking to, I think, the Secretary of Defense and being like, you know, get the president to do something. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to organize from Virginia. They're talking to the governor of Virginia, Northam, trying to get National Guard there. They're talking to Hogan in Delaware to try and get, is he in Maryland?
Hogan's Maryland, yeah.
Trying to get National Guards from there. I mean, you could see them scurrying around a lot to try and like...
Yeah. And that's important to put on the record because the Republicans were saying, what was Pelosi doing? Was she actually instigating the whole thing? And the truth is that they actually were acting. But that's the thing, to your point, Sam, like, why is this now? Why couldn't we have had this when Republicans were claiming Pelosi wasn't acting?
I think it is important to have on the record. I just wonder, in terms of the sequencing, this feels like something that should have come maybe over the summer. It's not the, doesn't seem like the capstone on this.
The capstone should have been that footage of that was really well done of the whole timeline of the descent onto the Capitol, where you intersperse it with, I believe, what Trump was saying at that time.
Right.
That was a lot more powerful than this kind of behind the scenes look at leadership.
And these recent revelations about what the Secret Service knew. I mean, they should have known, because anyone with a Twitter account should have known there was people expecting to do something that day, but they were really concerned with violence.
I think there's, you know, but that being said, it's on the record. I don't think Donald Trump is ever going to come and testify in front of this committee. I think the idea is he'll wait and see what happens in a couple of weeks. And if the Democrats lose control of the House, the committee is basically done. They'll issue their report and that'll be it. It is over. And then we will just have 2 years of Marjorie Taylor Greene, examining every pimple on Hunter Biden's buttocks. See that?
Lovely.
I can do that too. I'm not going to say ass.
On his hiney.
Yeah.
You poop mouth.
Sponsor for today, our only sponsor, SunsetLakeCBD.com. I got to get to sleep when I'm in Vegas. Sometimes it's a little hard. My heart is pumping and racing because of political arguments I've just had at the blackjack table at at 11 o'clock at night. I take my Sunset Lake. Well, generally, I use the tincture. But I've got the gummies with melatonin with me as I'm traveling. And... SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is Best gets you 20% off of all of their products. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls, keef. They have gummies that I mentioned. They have a full-spectrum gummy with a little bit of THC as well as CBD.
Oh, yeah, we're out of those.
Which my... I bet. My sister said, really, really, that... She gets a little loopy on those, she said. But they also have CBD with fudge. They have CBD with coffee. And they are a great company. They're movement partners. They've donated thousands of dollars to things like food pantries and strike funds and refugee resettlement funds. Just a great company. They have great business practices, $20 minimum wage. They mostly employee-owned company. They also have great farming practices. They integrated pest management. There's no pesticides. They use regenerative farming practices developed with the University of Vermont. Just an all-around great company and a great product. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. Get 20% off. Okay, so let's start with our first guest is here. Many of you know him through his YouTube program. Some of you may know him through Ring of Fire Radio. When I stopped doing Ring of Fire, and I should say, and I'm hoping to get Mike Papantonio down here at one point, but I started coming to this conference when I started doing Ring of Fire Radio, as I mentioned yesterday, with Mike Papantonio. And a lot of the people at this conference, it is largely run and partnered with the Levin Papantonio Rafferty law firm. And it goes back to Air America. But one of the earliest shows, I think, on YouTube, lefty shows, was Go Left, hosted by Farron Cousins. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Farron Cousins to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here. And I got to say, too, it's a little weird because I'm sitting here looking at you, but looking at myself, looking over your shoulder back at me. I know everybody can't see the background, but there's my giant face behind you. So
yes,
it's a little unsettling.
America's lawyers. But you guys started off Go Left in 2006?
Yeah, late 2006 by, first quarter 2007. We had it rolling. And that was it. We just did every day. We were in that studio 7 days a week at 5 a.m. doing news of the day, getting it out there. And we just didn't really stop. We kept it going. And eventually we put it on YouTube because we had made the mistake. That was the early days of YouTube. So we're like, we'll host our own videos.
Right.
So it became a giant money pit because that is very expensive. But we ported it over to YouTube, did a little bit here and there, and then really just started cranking it up again, 5 or 6 years ago. We thought, why aren't we just doing this all the time? So we built that out. We've got America's Lawyer home at our YouTube channel now. So the Ring of Fire podcast videos go up there. It's great. And we just got a wonderful new studio earlier this year. So everything
is down in Pensacola, Florida.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Very red area. So we're the little blue speck in that deep red spot of Matt Gaetz's district there. So that's always fun.
Oh, that does sound fun. So, all right. Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in terms of the politics. Obviously, the most contentious parts of this, I guess, of 2022 are going to be the Senate races. And we have, I don't know, off the top of my head, maybe 8 or 10 that are really in play. New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Nevada is increasingly, I think, going to be the biggest potential loss for Democrats. Arguably, Florida. You'd have a better sense of that than I would. And Iowa, I don't know. And Ohio. I mean, so I guess that's 9.
Arizona.
And Arizona, 10. Thank you. And we're seeing these debates happen. One of the ones that I really, really wanted, Ron Johnson, I can't stand. I think he's an idiot, and I thought that he would be the most vulnerable. Right now, the polling doesn't look so great for Mandela Barnes. But let's play a clip from that debate. This is the least political, and on some level, this is the least political clip that we could play, it seems to me. But in terms of the implications of the election in Wisconsin, could be one of those things that actually sort of resonates. I don't know. I mean, you were telling me you were in Green Bay, was it, or Madison?
Appleton, just outside of Green Bay.
And over the summer, and you have a sense of this. And Matt, I think, you know, is from this sort of neighborhood, neck of the woods. But here is the most innocuous question you could imagine in a debate that in a million years I wouldn't play unless Ron Johnson had done this. And I think it's gonna cost him a few votes.
Grain of salt.
All right, we are down to one final question here, and both of you have said a lot tonight about each other. Now, when we traveled around the state talking with voters, we heard repeatedly from people tired of divisive politics and attack ads. So our final question here tonight is, both of you have been successful in life. You have 30 seconds here. Mr. Barnes, you go first. What do you find admirable about your opponent?
Well, no, seriously, I do think, you know, the senator has proven to be a family man, and I think that's admirable. You know, that's absolutely to be respected. He speaks about his family. He's done a lot to provide for them. I absolutely respect that.
Mr. Johnson.
I mean, likewise, I appreciate the fact that Lieutenant Governor Barnes had loving parents, a school teacher, father worked third shift, so he had, you know, good upbringing. I guess what puzzles me about that is, with that upbringing, why is he turned against America? I mean, why does he find the founding of America awful?
Somehow,
it puzzles me. We did not.
I said Please, we sorry. Said something admirable, so. And.
Now, I got to say, like, the premise of the question is, we've gone around the state and people are tired of the nasty politics. And Ron Johnson cannot help himself. And you can hear the boos in the thing. And I just, I've been out to Madison a couple of times, actually, in my life. For weddings and for protests and I've known a lot of people from Wisconsin, and like, they place a high value on being nice, it seems to me. What's your sense? Do you think he's going to pay a price for that?
He definitely could. I mean, that really is a good, palpable feeling that you can feel in those areas where you do have these real nasty races. People do get sick of it. I mean, they've done tons of polling about, you know, the states with the nastiest type ads. And the folks in Wisconsin, the ones I've talked to, the my wife's family is all from there. They're not only sick of the anger, the hatred, you know, they get mad, they turn it off. But they're also asking, just do something. Right? Like in a nonpartisan way, like, we just want somebody who's going to do something. You know, come out, show us this, tell us things. You don't have to sit there and trash your opponent. So it actually could resonate with some of those people, the working class people who aren't paying too much attention, but who change the channel every time they oh, great, I was watching Wheel of Fortune and now I got this crap on my TV.
Right.
And they do that. They will flip away from it. So we'll see. I mean, you know, there's a couple of weeks. Maybe he can fix.
I mean,
attacking him.
You know, people say they don't like attack ads, but they're effective.
They are,
but they're also usually not the candidate, right? Like, I mean, the attack ads are always like at arm's length from the candidate. The candidate's not out there actually levying the attacks. They have a third party spokesman do it, or just like a narrator. And this, I don't know, is a little different. Matt, what's your sense? You're Minnesota.
Yeah,
you're like, North Dakota, but that's like Minnesota.
Well, yeah, I mean, North Dakota is very. Yeah, there's a lot of cultural runoff into North Dakota, and it's the same thing Farron said, which is people are really upset by the, like, people are animated by negative partisanship, but they're also sick of it consciously.
Yeah.
And so, when Hillary was just running against Trump, I heard a lot of people say, like, well, she can't say anything but a negative against Trump. And in Minnesota, like, just across the way from Wisconsin, you have a concept called Minnesota Nice, which is all about conflict aversion and keeping up appearances. And so when I see Johnson, like, if I imagine myself doing that in a high school debate and failing to just say something nice about the person, I imagine losing the crowd horribly like that myself.
Yeah, I actually think that's going to have some resonance. I just love the concept of Minnesota Nice, because I just can't even imagine like Massachusetts Nice. Massachusetts Nice is like Yeah, you can go into the rotary after I go into the fucking rotary, okay? And if you don't like it, you know, just go suck it, buddy.
So it's a good strategy, though. I mean, are you going to start employing that? Like, if you have David Dayan on, say, all right, David, you've talked a lot about Wall Street. Now I want you to say something you admire about them, you know, just to even things out a little bit.
Probably not. All right. So what is your sense of what's happening with the midterms? I mean, well, let me ask you this. Do you think the January 6th hearings, what's the value of them?
I think the value is keeping it fresh in people's minds. And, you know, you've been doing this long enough. You understand, as horrible as things can be and as big of mistakes that can be made, there's always enough time to forget it. And I think had we not done these hearings, the events of January 6th would be a distant memory for a lot of people. Maybe not everybody, but a lot of people would have moved on and just kind of their own memories would have tricked them into thinking it wasn't that bad. But by doing these hearings, especially all throughout the summer, the one last night, it puts it back in the forefront of people's minds. It keeps it there. It reminds them of what happened, and it shows them the inner workings of how terrifying it actually was on the inside. So I think there is a lot of value to it. Is it gonna change anybody's minds, though? Right? That's where we have to get down to it. Obviously, people on the left, we're still pissed. So that's not gonna change how I'm gonna vote. But for the average person out there tuning into this, if they didn't come in with any, you know, leaning one way or the other, does it make them go to the left? Does it make them more sympathetic to the right? That's what is the big question mark. I can't imagine anybody watching it and thinking, oh, yes, I like Republicans more now. But does it energize them to get out there or change the way somebody was planning on voting? I don't know.
I can't tell if they – I mean, I don't – I mean, obviously there's political value to it in the way that you're talking about it. But it seems to me if they were going to optimize that, they would have featured, I mean, one of the things I was struck by the footage of Pelosi and Schumer is like, they're like in negotiations with the people who crashed the Capitol. Like they're saying like, well, maybe if we will you guys be satisfied and just like, saying that the Arizona electors are not justified. And they ended up, I think, doing two states. I can't remember the second state now. But I almost feel like if you're going to maximize the political value of this, you show those senators who still afterwards are basically doing the bidding of the president. You show those congresspeople who all voted, you know, a lot of Republican congresspeople voted to not certify the election. And like, if you want to capitalize on the politics, you show that.
Yeah.
You know, in your little video presentations. I think not only do you do that for political reasons, you do that for the same reason which I think that they're doing this, which is we need to put it on the record. There is value in bearing some witness. This needs to be in the historical record, which I think is all well and good. I think that's very important. But you can do both at the same time. The Democrats are still so afraid of being seen as being political. And I don't know by whom. It's like they are playing still to these like same, I don't know, three Beltway reporters who they want so desperately to basically, you know, acknowledge they're responsible ones and they're not going to, I mean, it's absurd. And I feel like they didn't do enough politically for it. But I also think that like in their desperate attempt to not be seen as political, that they're also underselling what was going on here. This was not just Donald Trump and the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. There was another component, Ron Johnson. Like, how are you not talking about the fact that Ron Johnson was like trying to get to Mike Pence? People remember this when he was trying to get to Mike Pence saying like, you know, don't certify the election. I mean, this is a big deal.
And well, and Johnson has changed his story. I think three or four different times about his involvement. First, I had no idea. then it was
just a, it was just a message from the constituent.
Yeah, and
the intern gave it to me, and I gave it to, I was going to give it to the vice president.
Yeah, because Johnson, apparently anything an intern hands him, he's like, well, I guess I got to give this to Mike Pence. Like, that's not even how that would work.
No.
But, and then it was only a couple seconds. And now last week was, well, I may have been involved for an hour. I mean, God, the guy can't keep the story straight. That should be running in ads, by the way, in Wisconsin. I think that's very powerful to let him know, like, hey, your guy literally had the paperwork in his hand to try to overturn this election.
I mean,
your votes. He tried to overturn your votes. That's the message they should send.
And it hadn't even occurred to me. So I started talking about this, like, remembering that, like, you know, and putting Johnson together. And it's like, would that be a political thing to do? Yes. But would it be exclusively a political thing to do? No. I mean, if you're going to really put this on the record, you need to show the complicity of people like this. Because at the end of the day, the only reason why this thing could fail or succeed is not a function of, like, whether Donald Trump made it to the Capitol or whether these Oath Keepers, you know, or Proud Boys brought in the, you know, the right AR-15 or whatever it was. It's like what all the senators and the Congress people who are basically validating the whole exercise. And to not include them in that indictment, I think does a disservice to the things that the Democrats who were... does a disservice to the very goal of the Democrats that had and caused them to keep that absent. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's not a full record. It's not a complete record. And in many respects, it's not showing the real pivot points here. The reason why it was so close was because you had, you know, these ding-dongs, Ron Johnson and crew, who were willing to go along with it. You know, I don't know, Dan Quayle may have saved the country by just basically saying to Mike Pence, like, dude, you can't do this. You serious? You're not going to get away with it.
Well, it's really fascinating, too, on that note, to think because of the incompetence of the people involved, because you had people like Ron Johnson or Mike Lindell. If you change out, and Rudy Giuliani, you change out two or three of those guys with somebody else. Instead of Ron Johnson, if it was Mitch McConnell, suddenly you got a different outcome. Instead of Roger Stone, if it was Karl Rove, you may have had a different outcome. Instead of Mike Lindell, if you had had a Rock, anything could have been different. I mean, if you had Dershowitz instead of Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani, two or three people made the difference, and we're lucky that Trump surrounded himself with the dumbest people on the planet. Otherwise, it would have been a very different outcome on January 6th.
Yeah, and really, ostensibly, that's what these hearings are about, is to hold Trump to account, but also to sort of like prevent something like this from happening in the future. And it sort of feels like all you need next time is, you know, someone marginally smarter than Trump. Maybe it's DeSantis. Maybe it's Tom Cotton. I don't know. But I don't know. I would have ended the hearings in a slightly different way. That's I think where I would have gone with that. Other races. Are there any other races that stick out for you? There's in some way surprising, or you think there's a particular interesting chance that we have here?
I've been hyper focused on Georgia. Just being in Florida, and Georgia's right above us. It's our hat as a state. So obviously the Herschel Walker saga, and it is weird being in Florida because we see more on our news about Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock than we do Demings versus Rubio. I mean, there's, and I'll tell you this too, and maybe it's changed. I haven't been there for 4 days, but I have yet to see a Charlie Crist ad on my TV. I have not seen a Val Demings ad
on my TV. You're the third person this morning to tell me that they haven't seen a Charlie Crist ad on TV.
I feel like the Democratic Party has totally abandoned Florida. But look, DeSantis is up 11 points over Charlie Crist, who is not a good candidate anyway.
Why? Oh, and I should say, for longtime listeners of the show, I ran into Mike in Florida, who's attending the conference, longtime listener of this program, longtime caller, has been making this point about Florida Democrats for, I don't know, three cycles, I feel like. Why is Charlie Crist apparently the only person who can run for statewide office as a Democrat?
He is the only person, by the way, who holds the distinction in history of losing a statewide race as a Republican, as an independent, and as a Democrat. So, I mean, that is...
Like, honestly, like, what...
The trifecta of Loserville, and Charlie Crist is at it again. And we had Nikki Fried, first Democrat to win a statewide office in God knows how many years, because we haven't had a Democrat statewide office in 94. So what happened in that? Crist beat her because he's got the name recognition, and Crist has a lot of very wealthy friends. A lot of people that we've probably seen last couple hours here. But
oh, really?
He's very connected with the Florida trial lawyer scene. In fact, after he left the governorship, he went and worked once again as a trial lawyer. So he's connected to some of the biggest and baddest folks there. He's got the money. He's got the party. So he was able to just demolish Nikki Fried, who she's done a lot of things I don't agree with, but she was still better because it's something different than the same guy who's run now three different times.
I mean, honestly, how do you look yourself in the mirror and go, like, I've lost in every possible way? It's almost like he's in a competition. Like, how many times can I lose? And in what different ways can I lose? I can lose as a Republican. I can lose as a Democrat. I can lose as... a governor, a senator.
So next up, I guess he's got to switch to Libertarian and then lose, and then maybe a Green Party loss, and then he'll just really have that crown of the worst loser in Florida history. But no, I think a lot of people still look at Florida as a swing state, but we're just as red, basically, as Alabama, which everybody says, oh, Alabama's a lost cause. Alabama had a Democratic governor more recently by 10 years than Florida has.
And he was taken out by the Bush, Don Siegelman.
Yeah.
Was taken out by the Bush U.S. attorneys. Really dubious prosecution of Siegelman. I mean, someday we'll get back into that what's going on in a lot of those southern states where you have, like, judges who run for office and the incredible influence that has been exerted upon them, and U.S. attorney, particularly around 2004, 2005, I think it was after George W. Bush got reelected, there was a lot of pressure to find examples of voter fraud, which none of them could and were fired. I think Chris Christie did a couple of prosecutions. He was one of that crew that seemed to stay in the good graces of the Bush people. And down in Alabama. It seems pretty messed up. Give me your sense of, like, what's going to happen if the Republicans take Congress? Like, what are we going to see at that point?
I think... You know, and this is based on what they've said with their, you know, their plan for America, or whatever that was called. There's 70 different topics and individuals that they're going to launch investigations on. 70. Obviously, Hunter Biden and Hunter Biden's computer habits. The 2020 right. election they want to investigate. The funding, the money being spent by the January 6th committee. That's a topic of investigation. We're going to investigate how the investigation is spending money, and just so many other things. So that's all we're going to see. And it's going to create gridlock. We're going to have, you know, budget battles. We're going to have shutdowns, and everybody needs to go ahead and prepare for that, because those are things that will happen, because their focus is investigations, not legislation. But that ultimately could backfire in 2024.
Right.
Which actually McCarthy had mentioned that. I think it was April or May. He said, no, we're not going to do this. That's going to be terrible for us in 2024. But now he's he's been influenced, according to Matt Gaetz, by Gaetz and Jordan to go along with all the investigations.
Well, I think he has no choice.
Right.
I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's like the
do it or you're out.
Yeah, exactly. And it I guess it will remain to be seen, you know, if these hearings will end up being anything. I mean, you know, like what I find stunning is there is no, and you and I know this because you've been in this sort of like media space for more or less for the same amount of time. You think about all of the hype that was generated by the Durham investigation and all of the sort of lurid details that we were, you know, just around the corner from hearing on this investigation of the investigators and all the Russia hoax. And like, and people should understand, when you hear somebody say like Russia, 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 or Russiagate, there has been an investigation that is twice as long in terms of time, maybe close to three times as long as the Mueller investigation. It has been ongoing investigating these people. And yesterday or 2 days ago, the prosecution on one of the people got, began that was basically about maybe was, you know, supposedly lying about something, maybe second hand, it's still something inappropriate, but it's completely falling apart. Like the Durham was like arguing with his own, with the prosecution witness on the stand as if he hadn't even know what was going on. I mean, it has been such a debacle, and the coverage of it is nil.
Yeah.
Nil. And when we heard so much about the investigators, how corrupt the Mueller investigation led to, like, I don't know, like 35 indictments, and only later do we find out how narrow it was tailored and how much pressure they were getting from Bill Barr. And this Durham thing, the guys had full and free rein and nothing.
Yeah, his grand jury disbanded 2-3 weeks ago. And so that was essentially the end of it. Obviously, we still have this last prosecution, which, as you said, really not going the way Durham probably thought it would. But there was no coverage of it. You had all these folks, including some of the folks who, you know, the pretend left folk who thought, oh, the Durham thing, we're going to get the Hillary Clinton folks. We're going to get all these people. We're going to show. Where are you now? Yeah. Like, what do you have to say for hyping up this? This is the nothing burger. Because you couldn't even get Hillary Clinton's lawyer. You're like, oh, we got him. He lied. He lied to the FBI. And then, no, he gets acquitted. And he got acquitted in, what, like 2 hours?
Yeah. I sat on a jury that we were deliberating I don't even think it was a DUI. It was like a, you know, a left-hand turn that was inappropriate that may have been a DUI. I can't remember now. But I think it took just about the same amount of time.
And that's what we've seen from this. And, of course, that's the beauty of conservative media. They always talk about the thing when it happens, but there's never the follow-up.
Well, of course not.
Right.
I mean, they got their job to do, which is, you know, I guess what I'm talking about is the absence of a media, of a counterbalance to that media. There just doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I mean, and part of that may be in some part, you know, a function of like our ideology in terms of what we're going to cover. And I think certainly in terms of our size and in terms of funding and in terms of like having some type of, you know, flow chart, there's no one from the YouTube world who gets on Chris Hayes's program or, you know, Alex Wagner that doesn't happen. There's no pipeline to that. But if you're a YouTube or Twitter or, you know, conservative or, you know, have started your own little enterprise, it's a complete feeder system. I mean, and you know, and I should say, like, I was on MSNBC before I was on YouTube. For me, it went the other way. Like, MSNBC was my gateway to YouTube. But on the right, it's a totally different ballgame. And there is, it's never going to happen, left of center, in this country, just by the nature of it. But it really, people need to be aware of how it influences their perspective on issues and whatnot.
Well, and they've got their big conferences where they rent out these massive auditoriums and they've got fireworks on the side of the stage when Charlie Kirk walks out. Right. I mean, we're not ever going to have that. I mean, you know, we're lucky if we can get, you know, a couple hundred people to say hi to us when we walk down the street.
Yeah, you get trivia night at Netroots Nation. That's what you get.
And even Netroots, which I like it, it's great, but it's still, you know, it's not enough by any stretch. I mean, we're having Turning Point conferences, CPAC conferences. Those are no longer once a year.
Right.
We're getting those every 2 to 3 months, one of them doing a massive thing.
Yeah.
And it's not just the, you know, putting the right-wing speakers out there, but putting these politicians within arm's reach of these crowds. And that does work for those people. Like, oh my, it's like going to see a concert and you see these people, larger than life figures you've only seen on TV. Seeing them eye to eye in person makes an impression that the value of which cannot be understated. And we need that.
And it also creates a, you know, like just a money making circuit for all these people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing, amazing enterprise. But Farron Cousins, always a pleasure. People can check out, well, the Ring of Fire podcast that is available on iTunes. And in fact, you have a great guest this week.
I do. Some of y'all may have heard of him. He hosts a show called The Majority Report, I think it is. Samuel Cedar.
Thank you.
ROFpodcast.com for that.
And then, of course, you got Ring of Fire on YouTube.
Yeah.
What's the YouTube?
YouTube.com/TheRingOfFire.
And then Farron Balanced?
Farron Balanced. YouTube.com/FarronBalanced. That's my personal one. Very political, but a lot more fun and laid back. And then, of course, you know, take that Farron Balanced name, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find me with that all across. And if anybody didn't know, Sam is the one who came up with Farron Balanced.
Did I?
Because you, the very first interview I ever did was with you on Air America.
Okay.
Promoting Go Left TV. And you're like, Farron Cousins. You're like, or we should call you Farron Balanced.
Oh, well.
That so that's props
to you.
It would
have been nice to get a little bit of remuneration for that. But maybe we can talk about that. All right. Farron, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Appreciate it, man.
All right. I think if we're lucky, we'll have Mike Papantonio here. I wanted to talk to him because to do a little reset of what, you know, what I'm doing here on a it used to be twice a year basis. Here he is. He's coming to sit down right now. Very excited. Let's go to the two shot. I've got Mike Papantonio here. It is a real pleasure for me to welcome back to the program someone who I have known first as a guest and almost like sort of a, I don't want to say a boss, but you were like, you know, one of the people early investors in Air America.
I paid all the bills.
Yeah, exactly. And then as a co-host, we co-hosted Ring of Fire Radio for, I don't know, at least 5 years.
A long, interesting history.
And one of the top plaintiff's attorneys in the country who, I think the last time we spoke, you had just won the first case against DuPont on that issue of C8, which I think people know maybe from that that film, Dirty Water, I think it was.
Dark Waters and The Devil We Know.
Right? And Mike Papantonio. You've been in Jesus Camp, I think, was that documentary. Yeah. I mean, many, many documentaries, but I think that one comes up in the office every now and then. Mike Papantonio, real pleasure to have you on the show.
How are you, Sam?
I'm doing okay.
you know, as you're talking about our history is interesting. You know, think of the courage of what we tried to do. I mean, not my courage, and not just your courage singularly, but the collective courage of building something like Air America. But for the bizarre leadership, and but for the insanity of the people, the corporate types, it would have been a massive success. We had you, we had Janine Garofalo, we had Chuck D, we had Bobby Kennedy, Al Franken. Rachel Maddow, Liz Winstead.
Right.
It's just incredible arrangement of people. We had the best progressive talkers in America. The thing that we understood from the outset was that, you know, who are we talking about? We're talking about corporate America most of the time.
Yep.
So it's not like Ford International wants to call us and say, hey.
At one point it became, I think, public knowledge that there was a blacklist of there was advertisers just wouldn't advertise on Air America at the time. And we went through, I think, five different owners and six CEOs. And the irony was we had the numbers. We just didn't have, but
it's amazing. I'm fascinated when I look back on that history to say just the law of averages from the standpoint of the leadership that came in. We should have succeeded, but I think you said it was five iterations. Every one of them was bad. It was bad to worse to worse. It wasn't the talent.
No.
The talent was delivering everything needed to be delivered. But it was these knuckleheads that were making decisions that were killing the entire network.
Yeah. We could talk for hours about that, but I want to talk about and I should say, like, I literally wrote a script for AMC television about that time and sort of mashed them in together. And they thought it was a wonderful piece of fiction. And it was not. But, all right. But you mentioned, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about corporations during that time. And one of the things, I think you and I have had this conversation. You know, I was raised by a lawyer who was the son of a lawyer, and I never understood what trial lawyers did. And trial lawyers in this country have had, the media has really worked overtime to create this, and it's less now, but it was certainly more prominent like 10 years ago. And I'm not convinced that, frankly, a lot of the work that you've done hasn't helped that. But, you know, people used to talk about, like, the lady who sued McDonald's because her coffee was too hot. And I met the filmmaker of Hot Coffee here, who basically just showed how that was just a manipulation of because corporate America does not like you and your ilk, because you guys are basically like almost like you're like the deputies. And then sometimes you end up being the sheriffs because the actual sheriffs can't be on patrol. Will you talk about the dynamic between legislation and what you guys do?
Good point. Listen, the corporate America looks at it this way. They know they can own the politicians. They know they can own the media. The media is become so dysfunctional. They're never going to tell a story. For example, opioids, they never told that story until we launched the lawsuit. They know that they control the legislators and the regulators because they're the people that get them placed in office. They're the ones that spread the money around. But the real bugaboo, let me add this. They know now they can control the judges. We think that, if one political party is better than the other on appointing judges, that is fantasy talk. It's mythology.
Right.
If I were to look at the Clinton appointments or the Obama appointments and compare them to the Bush appointments, I wouldn't see a difference. I mean, they know they can control that.
Right.
But the thing they can't control is the trial lawyer who puts everything on the line. Opioids is a great example. I mean, you know, most of the firms that are handling that are $30 to $40 million out of their own pocket just to make this happen. Why did we have to make it happen? Why didn't the Department of Justice do what they should have done and prosecuted these sociopaths? Why didn't the legislators, when this started happening and it was very clear what was going on, why didn't they take action? Why didn't the media talk about it? Because the advertisers were paying so much money. McKesson, Cardinal, AmerisourceBergen, CVS, all this money was flowing to the media. And so they were making telephone, and we know this because the documents show it. So they're making calls to the media. Don't you dare do this story about opioids. If we do, we're going to pull back our advertising. Same thing they did with us on Air America.
And in fact, I remember, and we spoke at length over in the past years that we've been here about opioids. We were talking about that case, that CA case, for years leading up to it. I do remember, like, McKesson and those distributors were trying to get the law changed just as, like, you guys were starting to ramp up because they wanted to get protection. Nobody knows about this thing, so it's the best time for them to go in, tell lawmakers.
DuPont, for example, you hit it on the head. DuPont on C8, PFAS. The American public knew nothing about PFAS. You understand?
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, this young lawyer from Ohio comes to me and says, "Pap, can you help us build this project? Will you try these cases?" And all of a sudden, we understand that in everybody's drinking water, there's something called PFAS, and it will friggin' kill you, okay? Regulators have known about it forever. Congress has even had hearings on it. They've done very little to change it. The media has kept it quiet. The media knew this story years ago because we told it to them, and they kept it quiet. So if we don't go forward and we don't make headlines by saying, you know, we got another $300 million verdict, nobody pays attention to it. If you, in your media job, don't take that message and keep it out there with a shelf life more than 24 hours, people forget about it. So it's so complex. It's so complex. I've worked it both from the media side and the actual lawyering side where I'm trying the cases. I've seen all the chemistry, the interaction, the infrastructure of how corporate America holds us back. And you're right. I don't think there's this attitude anymore that lawyers are all bad, because they're seeing real changes that all but for lawyers would never occur.
Right. I mean, he was ill yesterday, but we were going to have the attorney who's representing some of the parents in the defamation suit against Alex Jones in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about what, over the years, the thing that I have been amazed is that really, I mean, just has shocked me over and over again, whether it was a story of, like, Remington rifles, whether it was a story of C8, whether it's a story of, vaginal mesh that's used, or talcum powder. You guys end up, and I remember you telling me the story about C8, like, DuPont thought, like, okay, we're just... You guys want documents? Here's 10 million documents. Good luck with that. And one of the things that your firm has been able to do, because, you know, ranging from the late Fred Lemon, who was, you know, instrumental in putting together the tobacco settlement, you guys sat on the committee for the BP settlement, was you guys have enough money where you can hire people to go through those documents, and you end up knowing more about what's there in their internal documents than they do. But the documents, I still can't get over how somebody in the C-suite can go, yeah, you know, we screwed up when we developed that drug, but we spent so much money in developing it. We need to sell and sell and sell, and we'll just pay it off.
It's a cost of doing business. Yeah. Let's figure how many people we're going to kill. How much can we settle each one of those lives for? For example, in any of the cases, you hear this, you know, Papantonio settles something for $4 billion. Well, that corporation has probably made $100 billion killing somebody, okay? killing many, many people. And so when they see that settlement headline, they go, oh, my God, poor corporation. Well, no, the corporations made the calculation, and they said, we're going to sell this product because we think we're going to only kill this many people. We've actually seen the documents, Sam, where an actuarial takes a metric, understands this many people will die. We know that because we have the clinical data. We put the drug on the market. We know how many people are going to die. This many people are going to have a life-threatening injury for the rest of their life. So each one of those has a value, right?
Yeah, we estimate $5 million for this.
Exactly. So they can estimate up front when they're doing clinicals, if we put this on the market and it kills X number of people, we're going to make on this product $110 billion. So we've got $10 billion that we can throw around. And it's exactly, this isn't fantasy talk. I don't think there's been a case that I've handled where I have not seen a document that does an actuarial metric calculation of what they have to pay after they kill X number of people.
It's stunning. And, you know, you can see, you know, for instance, okay, so in Texas, just to use the defamation suit because it's on everybody's mind now, Alex Jones loses this award. I can't remember, maybe $50 million, I think it was, in Texas. But there's a cap. So when you hear things like tort reform, like, well, we could put a cap on it. The reason why you don't put a cap on it is because Alex Jones knew there was a cap in Texas. He made the calculation that I'm going to forget about the legal part. I'll just let that go forward. I'm going to use the fact that they are suing me to raise more money, and I can buy my way out of this.
Exactly.
It's the same dynamic, except for in this instance, they're just corporate enough, and there's just enough number pushers to figure out, like, okay, we'll have to pay this out if somebody comes after us. But if we can elongate that process by a couple of years, our sales will be at this point, and it's just like, it's just another fixed cost. It's like rent, but in this case,
it's the way of doing business in corporate America. You know, most of the time, Sam, what people don't understand is the folks making these decisions. If you were to take an MMPI, a personal profile, with any psychiatrist or psychologist uses, if you were to take that and do that for the leadership in most of these corporations, you would find a checklist. They would land on sociopath. That sounds like hyperbole. It's not. They're dressed up, sitting across the table. They're in Armani suit. They have a Rolex watch on. They drove up in their Bentley. They live in a, you know, gazillion dollar home. They're a sociopath who is above the fray, okay? And so we don't understand that the only way to deal with a sociopath is either put them in prison or take all of their money away. People hate when I talk about this because people have become so tribal in politics, Sam. It's disturbing to me. All I've ever done is progressive politics most of my life. But when I talk about this thing that I want to talk to you about, people get so upset. And what it is we don't have a way to control what the Democrats do or the Republicans do in the way that they've created a system that perpetuates itself. For example, HSBC. Do you remember that case? HSBC was where we caught them, the biggest bank in Europe, laundering money.
They had to, for terrorists. They also had to, I know they did it for Mexican drug cartels.
Oh, yeah.
They literally had to change the glass partitions so that they could push through the boxes of money.
That's correct. So it was hundreds of billions of dollars, okay? So this was Eric Holder, Democrat, had all the information. They had a 16-page document. Yes, we washed money for terrorism. Yes, we understood that American soldiers were going to be killed. Yes, we made $100 billion. And so what? So they signed the document. They pay out $1.6 billion. Nobody goes to prison at all. Nobody goes to prison. Opioids. How about this one? opioids, we have them dead to rights in Colorado, where the documents that are being produced by the company say, yeah, we understand this is killing people. We understand that this big lie we've told is just a lie, that we're telling doctors this is not addictive. Keep perpetuating the lie. This is in their documents. The documents are overwhelmingly showing clear criminal conduct. The local prosecutors in Colorado, they want to do something about it. It goes up to Eric Holder's Department of Justice, and they refuse to prosecute. Right. There's stories like this all over our history.
Well, we saw it also in the financial meltdown. I mean,
of course,
it was Lanny Brewer, I think, was number two under Holder, who said. Was basically saying, like, yeah, no, these guys are too big to jail. We can't
put them in jail. They have MBAs from Harvard.
Yeah.
My God, we can't put them in jail. Sam, do you remember the case, the Factor VIII case, where hemophiliac children were being given something called a Factor VIII, which was a blood clotting element? We found out that it was infected with AIDS. We got them to take it off the market in the U.S. The same batches that they took off the market in the U.S., all the stuff they had left, they shipped to Asia and Europe. Hundreds and hundreds of families were infected with AIDS. The Department of Justice knew it. The decisions were made right here in America, and nobody went to prison. Yeah, nobody was even investigated.
Let me ask you just one question about the relationship between legislation and the work you do, because I don't know if people have a clear sense of this. There was legislation that was passed, I guess maybe a month ago, which I can't remember what the public sort of vernacular, what they were calling it about the,
Camp Lejeune. Are we talking about?
Yes, but I think they're referring to, I mean, it was a vets bill,
yes,
a vets protection bill, and I think they were calling it vets fire.
Obama signed that in 2012. Obama put life in that possibility. This was where, I don't know if you've done a show on this already, but this is where thousands, I'm talking about 50,000, 100,000, 500,000, we don't know what the number is. We think it's somewhere around 500,000. Families, children, mothers, Marine, were all infected with the worst VOCs, which is if you took the top 10 most toxic chemicals on the friggin' planet, toxic chemicals produced by industry, if you took those, three of those were in the drinking water at Camp Lejeune. And children died of leukemia, brain cancer. We had birth defects. People are still dying from latent disease related to that. Now, the problem with that is you had you have every knucklehead in the world believes they can handle that case. So there's this big barrage of advertising. Most of that advertising is not even lawyers. They're not even lawyers. They're simply what we call case aggregators trying to collect cases. They don't know how to evaluate the case. And then they find some cat that's got a two-man law firm. And they say, hey, would you handle these 5,000 cases for us? Well, what ends up happening is the 5,000 cases, about 25, 30% of them are totally fraudulent. And that lawyer who believes that, oh, this is my big payday, I'm going to handle these thousands of cases, well, they end up doing such a disservice because they're promoting a fraud where you have people who are actually dead and dying because of the conduct of the U.S. government, the cover-up that started in 1951 and continued until 2011, covering up, not just completely lying to these people about what they have been exposed to and the damage it's done to them.
And I should say I think the vernacular was, they called it the burn pits legislation.
Yes.
But one of those elements, the overall element was allowing service men and women
to sue the government.
I don't think most people knew.
No, it was prevented.
It was illegal, essentially not allowed by statute. I think the last one was in the 1950s.
Yeah.
Yesterday, you know, at the luncheon, you were honoring one of the attorneys, or maybe the attorney.
Oh, absolutely.
Who pushed the legislation.
Ed Bell.
But I got to say, like, not only do I find him incredibly impressive, that story of Camp Lejeune, I don't think anybody, I certainly had never heard that there is literally a massive cemetery for babies
that died there.
That died there from being stillborn, or and he told an
it's 200 yards of graves of children who died of leukemia, all types of blood illnesses. They died of neurological illnesses, and it's a graveyard that is set aside for them. And the families that were there, they still have their children. They still have relatives that are dying because some of these diseases are so latent. If somebody had exposure in 1985, well, they may not have esophageal cancer until right now. You see, there's all types of cancers that they're latent manifestations. Parkinson's disease, great example. A lot of those folks that were exposed to this are dying of Parkinson's disease. But the problem is the government knew all this, Sam. Okay, they made, and you know why they kept, you know why they covered it up? Because they were worried about the plume, the aquifer plume, where this was all moving around. An aquifer plume can move miles and miles. So the plume was moving outside of Camp Lejeune. So the civilians outside, they had the right to sue the government. Wow. So the government kept it quiet. So those civilians who were also drinking the same toxic trash water wouldn't come in and sue the government.
That's nuts. I think that's like one of the more basic sort of examples of how legislation can allow for like civil action in this instance. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to talk to your daughter about that legislation. We're going to talk to her about
She's all into it. It's amazing. It's amazing the energy that we're really, really good lawyers are trying to do the right thing. The problem we're having to fight off are all these bottom feeders that are not even lawyers. They're getting money from Wall Street. Wall Street wants to take over the legal industry. The same way they took over the hospital industry.
I'm thinking in the spring, that is a story I really want to cover a lot. It's watching the financialization of every facet of our society is incredible. You got to go. Mike Papantonio, always a pleasure. Really appreciate your talking to us.
Thank you, Sam.
I can't appreciate thank you enough. All right, folks. Like I said, we're going to be talking to Mike's daughter, actually, shortly, about both. We may touch on that Camp Lejeune legislation, but also there's another story about baby formula. This Camp Lejeune thing is nuts. I saw a short video about some of this stuff, and it really is nuts. This guy Bell, the attorney, can we bring Emma in? Is she around?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
So the story was, one of the stories he was telling was about how he was lobbying Congress. He did this for 10 years, this lawyer, basically all on his own dime. It was really, the guy was, he can't even talk about this stuff without sort of having like almost breaking down. And he was retelling his story about how he got on the phone, or was it on Zoom, I think, with Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, congressman. Mm-hmm. And the Moulton was saying, well, can't the VA take care of this? Because it's military personnel. And the lawyer said, well, the VA doesn't cover, family members. And then he brought on a woman who was the wife of a Marine. And she said to the congressman, can I tell my story? And he said, yeah, of course. He goes, my husband. Oh, okay. Give me one sec. My husband you know, had leukemia. And he said, and can't the VA deal with that? And she said, well, no, the VA can't help him because he's dead now. And he said, that's horrible. And she says, and the VA can't help me. I am on a drip on a daily basis because of my leukemia. And he's like, oh. And then she said, and you know that also these drugs created, these chemicals created birth defects. And Morton said, yeah, that's my understanding as well. And she goes, can I introduce you to my son? And she turned the camera, and he was born without an arm. And it was, I mean, these stories are incredibly moving. And obviously, like, it took 10 years to get that legislation. But this is, you know, this is an example of what the kind of work that is being done. All right. I have another guest who's just sat down with me. I want to welcome to the program. Michael? Okay. Michael Watts. You're an attorney where?
Well, I live in Puerto Rico. My firm was based in San Antonio before I moved to Puerto Rico during the pandemic.
Okay. And you are working on a case that is, I mean, when I first heard about this, I was like, this is a touchy subject. Yeah. Because it deals with autism. And over the years, there have been many different suspects as to why there has been an increase in the rate of autism. And there's been speculation, is this an increase in the rate of reporting of autism? Is it an increase in the incidence of autism? And if it's the latter, what's causing it? Let me ask you that basic question. Like, what does the studies, the science say in terms of like the increase in autism in this country, I guess?
So the prevalence of autism has exploded. I mean, not just an increase, but an exponential increase over the last 30 years. So there's been a lot of suspicion about why is that so? And statisticians and clinicians have studied it, and they realize that about 25% of the increase is explained by better diagnostic tools and more awareness and the like, but 75% of it is not explained by an increase in reporting or vigilance of, you know, knowing what autism is. And so for about 25 years,
when did that increase? I mean, I imagine over the course of the past 25 years, the reporting has improved, yeah, you know, incrementally. But when does the science say that, like, there was this sort of real growth in
It's been over the last 30-35 years during the dramatic increase of the use of acetaminophen. But, you know, you can really track it back to the first President Bush with the Americans with Disabilities Act, where, you know, presumptively our public schools had the duty to make accommodations for learning challenged children. So they got really good at that. And there's all sorts of EID programs, which is in effect the systems that are in place to take care of kids that have intellectual disabilities or autism spectrum disorder and the like. And so the studies became very good beginning in about the 1990s. But what we've learned is very interesting. For whatever reason, acetaminophen is not available on the island of Cuba.
Okay. No, wait a second. I just want to back up because I hadn't introduced the theory, the claim. Because I just want to say, like, you know, for a while there was suspicion that it was mercury in vaccines. Around 2003, I think it was, there became a widespread attempt to remove thimerosal from the vaccines. And I remember at the beginning of my radio career interviewing people who basically said, we need to wait another year or two to get a sense of whether that thimerosal being removed from the vaccines has had any implications. And it turned out that it didn't. And so it feels like there's been a search for what caused this.
It's so interesting that you brought up the Marisol, because my journey in the autism causality inquiry started about 25 years ago with people trying to get my law firm involved in the vaccine litigation. And I did a lot of research in the 99, 2000, 2001 timeframe. And I remember very clearly, I didn't get in because it just didn't make sense to me that the post-birth administration of an agent would have that kind of neurological effect. And so I felt like it had to be something during the formation of the neurological systems, you know, in utero. And so I didn't get in. And as a result of the incredible due diligence we did about deciding whether to get into that litigation, you know, we got smart enough to be dangerous, if you will. But what I noticed over the next 20 years is we have a full-time doctor that works for us that helps us vet cases before we get involved and the like, is you started seeing kind of anecdotal statistical studies correlating an increased prevalence of autism in the presence of the use of acetaminophen.
And we should say, you're talking about the use of acetaminophen by
pregnant mothers. Yeah. So during pregnancy, not somebody that just takes it for a fever, you know, when they're, it's got to be while the fetus is being developed in the neurological system. But it passes through the placental barrier. So when mom takes acetaminophen, right, the baby is too.
All right. Before we get there, I'm curious about that process. So you, as an attorney, and this is one thing I think that, you know, I've come to understand, is that if you are a plaintiff's attorney, and this is the case with, I think, with, you know, even attorneys, my father was more of a transactional one, but he would have to learn businesses,
sure,
what they did, so that he could figure out the, you know, these different things, and different lawyers will sort of focus on different sort of like silos of knowledge,
right?
So you studied deeply about the vaccinations. You didn't find that that you felt that the causal link was substantial enough to invest. You know, sometimes you invest decades in pursuing these trials. Yeah. So you got to be pretty serious about. And so in that process, like when you say like you heard like anecdotal, like what, like how, so you come to believe, have a theory that this has to be in the neural development stage, so in utero.
Right.
And then, so what, like, how are you hearing those anecdotal stories? Are you saying just like casually, like, do you drink? Do you smoke? Do you eat this type of baked goods? Or what? Like,
well, when I said anecdotal, what I meant is studies would come out, but not a rush of them. So in the 2005, 2006, 2007 timeframe, of course, you know, as part of vetting potential pharmaceutical cases, we're reading all the medical journals and you see it come out and you say, huh, that's interesting. But, you know, as with any scientific theory, you need replication, you need repetitive studies, you know, as part of the scientific method. And about 2013, we had all sorts of warning flags and, interestingly, you know, the island of Cuba doesn't have acetaminophen, and their autism rate is 279 times lower than in the United States.
Are they the only place in the world that does?
No, there's other places, but that's the best. You know, because
it's a good control because they have, you know, a pretty good medical system.
People come in and out. They have a good medical system, but you know, they just don't use acetaminophen during for fevers or pain during pregnancy.
All right, let me ask you one more question about that comparison. Have we seen increase in autism rates around the world? Is this an American phenomenon or a world phenomenon?
It's anywhere.
Or an industrialized nation.
Yeah, it's anywhere. I mean, acetaminophen is sold around the world, as you know, and Tylenol is a worldwide product. So you see it increasing in a lot of different places. Now, you know, in the European countries, because you have socialized medicine that's very well tracked and good epidemiology, you see it. In the United States, we see it a lot because it's just pervasive. But one of the things that's interesting is you'll recall, you remember the time when somebody spiked the Tylenol capsules,
yes,
with cyanide and you know, Johnson & Johnson absolutely did the right thing, pulling it from the market immediately, and now we've got all those protective, you know, bottle caps.
This happened, 30, 40 years ago, I guess.
Yeah,
I remember.
Well, but there were studies done, And when that happened, the rate of sales of Tylenol fell through the floor, and it took years to come back.
Yes, I remember that.
And it turns out that the subsequent autism rates during that time plummeted.
Dip? Really?
And there were two different times when autism, I mean, when Tylenol sales plummeted, and the corresponding autism diagnosis rate 3, 4, 5 years later when autism was diagnosed went down. And so we saw that, and that was interesting. But since 2013, when the scientific community kind of put its ears up and said, okay, is there something here? There have been 19 different studies that have looked at whether there's a statistical correlation between acetaminophen use and an increased prevalence of autism. They all show an increase.
And we should be clear. When we say acetaminophen use, we're talking about during pregnancy. Now, what, like, is there a same incidence of autism if a pregnant woman takes, you know, one pill? I mean, what?
Like, so that's the other part of the Bradford Hill criteria about causation, is you want to see a dose response. In other words, when you have more acetaminophen being taken, is there a higher rate of autism than when you have less? And so there's a very interesting study done by the Boston Birth Cohort. And what that is they have thousands of women that come in and deliver at these various hospitals in Boston. And by permission of the woman, they take the cord blood and they store it in cryogenic chambers and like that. And they're able to test for what's in the cord blood. And what they did is they realized that when you divided up all of the cord blood that they studied into three tertiles, minimal acetaminophen levels in the cord blood versus pervasive acetaminophen levels, that there was a 3.62 times increase or relative risk of subsequent diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder 4, 5, 6 years later. And so that was kind of the gold standard, because number one, it replicated what 18 other studies have shown in terms of an increase, you know, but that showed dose response. When you have a lot of acetaminophen, the prevalence of autism goes through the roof. And so that's really what got us going, was that dose response stuff. And there are other studies that show a dose response, but you're just not going to see 19 studies in a row, all of whom show an increase.
Are these all peer reviewed?
Oh yeah.
Studies?
Yeah. Some of the finest medical journals in the United States, you know? And so, last year or 2 years ago, 91 scientists put out a consensus statement, saying, look, the studies are clear. And we need to start educating women to consider not using acetaminophen while they're pregnant. And they basically called for a warning, which...
Are there other... I mean, women are discouraged from using ibuprofen.
Absolutely.
Well, in NSAIDs, right?
Yes.
During pregnancy.
In fact, they're encouraged to use acetaminophen by most of the medical professionals until very recently when these studies started coming out. So it's a problem. I mean... every mom I've talked to says, the doc says, only use Tylenol or only use acetaminophen. Don't go anywhere near an NSAID. Don't go anywhere near ibuprofen, you know, because there's other reasons. But they're actively encouraged for pain and fever and the like to use acetaminophen.
What are the options for women? I mean, I have to say, like, look, when I heard about this case or heard about, I have to say, like, I'm hesitant.
I was too.
To just, you know, and I should say, like, I want to make it clear that, like, I'm not in a position to assess what you're talking about.
Sure.
Maybe we can point people to some of these studies and whatnot. And it also, you know, there doesn't seem to be many options for women who are pregnant in terms of, like, being able to treat
right.
What a painkiller would treat. So, you know, I just want to say this, you know, in terms of my audience right now, that, like, you know, we should always approach these things with a certain amount of skepticism. On
absolutely.
And people should.
That's called vetting a case.
Yes. Well, I understand. But it's, you know, we're at a time now where, like, we've gone through an extended period of time where people are saying, like, the COVID vaccine is going to, you know, make you magnetic.
Which I think is absurd.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah.
I mean, so I just want to tread lightly here on this. But so what has to happen now? Like what has to happen now? What is the government looking into this? Does the FDA look at this? Like how did we get to the point? Let's put it this way. How did we get to the point where ibuprofen, for instance, was discouraged by doctors for pregnant women?
You know, the science evolves, and studies are done, and you show the relationship between the administration of a certain agent and a
what
consequence.
What was the concern with pregnant women taking ibuprofen?
There were all sorts of concerns, and I forget, it's been so long. But, you know, for example, you know, 10, 12 years ago, a lot of us were in the Tokmax litigation. It was causing cleft palate and, you know, all sorts of malformations and like that. But the bottom line is certain medical substances, when administered while the baby is being formed, don't do well with that baby. And ibuprofen is one of them for a completely different reason. I forget the details of it, but I've known since I was a kid, you don't take ibuprofen. You know, my wife didn't go anywhere near it. But, you know, the real thing, and it is a challenge, right? Because mom does have pain. And, you know, this is the one part of my life where I'm really happy to be a male. I mean, what they go through is a miracle, and it's painful, and they need something. But it's not really the tort system's job to say, is it a good idea or a bad idea to warn mom about the potential consequence. Mom has the right to know. And in the same way that virtually every woman I know now who drinks wine or has a cocktail or this or that, as soon as they know they're pregnant, they go stone cold for 9 months, and they make that sacrifice for the good of their baby. And mom has a right to know that. And the problem is that for decades, the medical community, I'm not blaming the medical community, but they're passing out Tylenol like Rolaids or, you know, something you take every day. And, you know, the science has evolved to a point that mom needs to know that maybe you should take it at least sparingly.
Right.
You know, because of the consequences.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you know?
I think there's also been sort of like some reevaluation on, you know, moderate, very like reserved drinking of alcohol at various points during the course of a pregnancy is not as problematic as maybe there was an assumption that there was initially. But I guess it's really more of a question of like being moderate with any substance that can come in.
I think that's right. And you know, and certain people like my daughter, she didn't touch anything, no caffeine, no medicines, nothing during each of her three pregnancies. And a lot of women are like that, you know, but our job is to get the information to those women so that they can make that choice for themselves and their baby, you know, and that information has been withheld. There's not a word in the Tylenol or Excedrin or acetaminophen labels about this risk. And it's now a risk. It's been in a whole lot of studies.
And so where is the government at this point? I mean, if there's this much evidence that or studies that indicate high levels of use of acetaminophen during can lead to a greater incidence of autism, right? It's not a one-to-one type of situation.
Right.
But if that exists, where is the FDA?
Very few people realize that the big pharmaceutical companies employ hundreds of thousands of people. And the people who regulate them, the FDA, employs hundreds. And it's really a function of resources. And under the law, the pharmaceutical companies have the obligation to ensure that their drugs are safe and to make the warnings. It's not the FDA's obligation, even though they have regulatory oversight about it. But, you know, this is an over-the-counter drug. And so the FDA seems to be very centrically focused on prescription medicines, new medicines, and that's good. Okay. But, you know, these drugs that have been around for 30, 40 years, I saw it in the Zantac case where, you know, we know now all along there was a cancer-causing agent in Zantac. It was the number one selling drug in the world for decades, you know, and it's got this cancer-causing agent in DMA, and the FDA just missed it, you know. And so it's the scientist's job to study these things, look for the red flags, and they're finding them. And then, you know, the FDA is always lagging behind because they're not conducting these studies. It's the pharmaceutical companies, you know, conducting the studies. And this is why NIH grants are so important and the ability to perform medical science, because you catch things. And in this country, we have a trade-off. You know, it used to be it took forever to get a drug to market. Now we have fast-track approval. And that's a good thing because a lot of these pharmaceuticals are very good and save a lot of lives, but it also leads to mistakes. It also leads to signals that aren't caught during the preclinical and the clinical phase that can only be caught with good post-market surveillance. And sometimes that surveillance doesn't get done in favor of pursuit of the almighty dollar. I mean, this drug itself, for Johnson & Johnson, it's a $14 billion drug. You know, everybody buys Tylenol. And so we just need to get the information out there so that mom can decide whether she wants to be the one using it while she's forming the most precious thing she's ever going to do.
All right. Well, you know, if what I'd like to do is be able to get, like, you know, access to some of these studies.
Of course.
And you know, again, it's like we're in an environment now where I think rightly so, there's a big sensitivity to this type
Absolutely.
Of thing, particularly when it comes to autism. It's, you know, particularly centered around autism. There has been obviously just like a huge, you know, industry that has been developed around, and it's become this sort of massive anti-vax movement and whatnot. So I just want to be, you know, extra cautious on this.
I agree.
And so what happens next in terms of what you're pursuing?
So, we started filing lawsuits in June. We filed a motion in front of the judicial panel of multi-district litigation to have it consolidated into an MDL. I argued that motion on September the 29th. It was granted. We got assigned to the Honorable Denise Coate of the Southern District of New York. So we'll be headed to 500 Pearl Street in downtown Manhattan as soon as she orders us there, and we'll get going. There will be a big fight about the legal doctrine known as preemption. Johnson & Johnson, you know, GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of Excedrin, all of the store-branded acetaminophen sellers, you know, Kroger, Walmart, Walgreens, CVS are all in the case. So they'll all say it's preempted, and so we'll have to fight through that legal issue.
What does that mean by preempted?
Basically that we can't change the label, the FDA wouldn't let us, or something like that. It's called impossibility preemption. So we'll have that fight.
There was a piece in the CARES Act.
Yes.
There was and this is fascinating.
It finalized the monograph, yes.
Okay. Will you explain this concept of the monograph?
Sure.
Do you have a moment?
That's fine. So there's different regulatory structures for prescription medications versus over-the-counter medications, and there's different preemption rules. Basically, with respect to over-the-counter, they're going to have to prove that they couldn't change the label because the FDA wouldn't let them do it. It would be impossible.
All right. So just to be clear, when we say monograph, the FDA basically says this information needs to be on the label. We're going to write it out for you, essentially, or you must express the warnings. You must express the direction, and we're going to give you this amount of space to put your logo on there, and you know, and some vague claim of what it, you know, what it is or does,
and efficacy.
You need to be. And that's it. That's the template you can use. You're not allowed to change it. Is that basically what?
That's what they're going to argue. That's not the law. Companies can and do add information to monographs. And, for example, in Tylenol, there's information unrelated to autism that was added to the monograph by Johnson & Johnson. So they can add whatever they want unless the FDA says no. And so the impossibility preemption defense is, in effect, the court saying, well, look, if you ask the FDA to do something and they prohibit you from doing so, you shouldn't be sued for that.
Right.
And so that's the fight we're going to have.
Okay. So they're just arguing, regardless of what
the science says,
or, you know, one way or another, even if we stipulate that, we're not legally liable because we never had the ability to put the warning on the label anyways.
That's what they're going to try.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then if it gets past that, then you actually get into the
discovery. What did they know? When they knew it? Association between, you know,
what
acetaminophen.
What is the timeline of something like that?
Well, these MDL cases can take, you know, several years. On the good side, Judge Coate is a senior status judge, so presumably she's not bogged down by an enormous docket that'll put us in the back of the line. She's done 8 MDLs. She's known to be very efficient, and so I'm excited about that. So I think this thing will move pretty quickly because of the judge that we drew. She's excellent.
Let me ask you one more question about the you used Cuba as a benchmark.
That's one example. Yeah.
What other factors are controlled there for that? I mean, there's an absence of acetaminophen in Cuba. What about like age of the mother, for instance?
Yeah, these things all get controlled and match paired, you know, like good science does. I mean, it's pretty clear, you know. I mean, Cubans don't give birth older than we do. There's nothing there, and you
know, they're not younger in general.
No, not at all.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to look forward to hearing more about this case, and we'll get in touch with you and see if you can point us at least to some of these studies that we can make available. But I guess it is, you know, we will see where this leads.
We will.
But it is it's fascinating, and I wanted the opportunity for people to hear this.
All right.
Thanks so much.
You bet.
I appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Michael Watts. Again, folks, I want to just, you know, sort of reiterate here that, you know, this is a touchy subject, and I don't want to be, you know, putting stuff out there, but I have, you know, spoken to various attorneys around here as to, you know, sort of like, how legit does this sound? And there are some who said, like, well, there may be problems with that first element of the case, the monograph and the preemption, but largely this is a guy who does his due diligence. And I guess we will see. This is, you know, and this is one of those things. It's headed to the courts right now. So this is something that's going to, there's going to actually be some investigation. There'll be some, at least a resolution.
Yeah. The National Institute of Health and the Journal of American Medical Association are both, you know, investigating this. So
they are investigating it now.
Yeah. I sent you a link in the chat, but the NIH has a press release from a 2019, NIH funded study suggests acetaminophen exposure in pregnancy linked to higher risk of ADHD and autism.
Mm. Okay. Fair enough. All right. Well, you know, we'll follow up on this. I don't want people to freak out about it. And, you know, I think it's always a good idea, you know, for if be moderate in everything.
Yeah.
You know, that you ingest into your body, regardless of what it is. All right. We have another guest who's just shown up here.
Wow. Look at this.
Yep. There we go.
Yeah, you were worried that we wouldn't have anybody, but now we got people
coming in. And this is very exciting. Like, I want to welcome to the program Sarah Papantonio. You've followed your father into the legal profession. Here, come a little bit closer to the mic. Really appreciate your joining me. And you are working on a case involving baby formula. I spoke to your father a little bit about Camp Lejeune, and we got the details on that. But you're also working on a case about baby formula. Tell me about that case.
Right. So what you're seeing right now is a ton of bad press about the formula industry. And there's two different cases that are out there.
We should say that most of the press that we're hearing about is their failure.
Really, their failure to take care of families, their failure to, you know, protect infants, and their failure to manufacture these products in the right way. So the case that we're handling is dealing with premature infants who developed a disease called necrotizing enterocolitis. And the result of that is what's happening is these premature infants are being fed a cow's milk-based formula. This cow's milk-based formula is being advertised by the industry as being human milk and safe for premature infants. The reality of it is
it's being advertised as human
milk.
Advertised
as human milk. So the reality is what happens is the premature infant cannot properly digest that cow's milk enzyme. What happens when their bodies react to it is it ultimately creates decaying flesh. So the necrotizing enterocolitis means that the child's organs and intestinal tract is deteriorating. It's breaking down. It's turning into mush. It is a horrific injury that these children are facing. The whole point of this case is they don't have to. These companies have known for years, decades even, that premature infants are not able to digest the cow's milk enzyme, yet it is still being manufactured to them. So that's what we're pursuing, a cause of action on behalf of families and infants who have suffered injuries, who have lost their lives because of this cow's milk-based formula that is being marketed by the infant formula.
Let's back up and give me a sense of, like, how did this stuff come, how was this sort of discovered first off, how was it discovered, A, that there was this disease, which I cannot pronounce, that was taking place in premature babies? And then how was it established that, like, how did it come to be clear that there's a false advertising? I mean, I want to talk about, maybe there's dual claims here that can operate, but just walk us through that.
So there's a lot to break down here, and I think it's helpful if we kind of start from the inception of formula. We have decades worth of history that shows that these companies have misled the American public. They've misled international families about the safety of formula products. So if you think back to, I think it was in the 70s, you had Nestle go into Africa. And what they did is they got these mothers hooked on breast milk formula. Because what we are seeing is that the whole advertising scheme here is brand loyalty. That is the goal of these formula companies. They want to almost create addiction and addicts of their formula. So you had Nestle go into Africa, get all of these women addicted and their children addicted on the formula. So their breast milk dries up. But when Nestle comes out, those women can no longer afford formula. Their breast milk has dried up. And so you have infant deaths across Africa because they don't have the nutritional support they need because Nestle has gotten them hooked. The breast milk has dried up and they no longer can support their child. So that was kind of the first realization that these formula companies are not as baby friendly as we'd like to think. So then you evolve into the 90s and early 2000s, and what we're seeing is study after study after study that says cow's milk is not the proper form of nutrition for a premature infant alone. Why? Because of the reaction in the child's gut. They know that. The studies have been out there for years, yet they continue to perpetuate this narrative that these babies have to grow. They have to have the formula. They can't live without it. It's an absolute false and misleading advertising. It truly is. So when we talk about formula, you know, when you see the advertisements, when you see them flashing happy babies and loving families and mothers who are just so relieved that they're giving these families their babies formula, it is an absolute misleading truth. These advertising schemes that the infant formula companies are doing, I would equate them to big tobacco. I would equate them to the opioid marketing scheme. It is criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
How do you find these cases? Like, I mean, how did this, how does it go from that's going out there? Like, did you have clients that came in?
So the inception of this case started just as really any other case would. You spot a wrongdoing. You have a mother that comes to us and says, my child died of this necrotizing enterocolitis. I don't think it should have happened. I don't know why it happened, but I know something went wrong here. And then you have attorneys that start to look into it. They start to uncover the science. They start to see how obvious it is and how obvious it should be to these companies that their product is not safe for this infant population. And that creates a snowball effect. And that's what created this litigation. You start with one client. Word of mouth, you get two clients, three clients, and now we have thousands of people, thousands of mothers and children who have suffered at the hands of the formula companies. And we've created this shockwave across the country that is really bringing to light just how bad these formula companies are. Coupled with now you see the Similac recall cases where Abbott formula is essentially has terrible bacteria in all their facilities that is getting into the formula and then infecting the children. So we really have a lot of momentum against the formula companies right now for this litigation.
I see. And does the bacteria, which is obviously unrelated to this thing, but it shows this is a company that not necessarily putting the safety of babies before profits.
It shows that it's a company that is not operating with due diligence. They're not focused on the safety of the children. They're not focused on the good manufacturing practice. They're focused on getting these people addicted to formula and riding on that brand loyalty.
What do you need to prove if you go to court? Well, let me start with this. It's a multi-district litigation. Why is it? What's the difference between that and a class action suit?
So it's very important to make that distinction. What we call multi-district litigations, we call mass tort cases. And what that means is that we represent the individual on every single case. We work up the individual's cases. We try their cases based on what happened specifically to them. Class action is very different because class action is where we pursue what is called an economic loss. That means all you're able to recover is that which you have spent money on. So for instance, if mothers went out and purchased the infant formula that ultimately injured their children, they would only be able to recover the money spent purchasing that product. Now, what we are able to do in our mass torts MDL world is we are able to represent that mother. We are able to show a jury the injuries these children have suffered, and we're able to recover both economic damages, those financial losses, as well as what we call non-economic damages. That's the pain and suffering this family has been through. It's the injuries that we can't see or touch, but that we feel. It's what effect that's going to have on this child's life who now has half of his intestinal tract taken out because of the necrotizing enterocolitis. So there's real value in these mass torts because we're able to tell the story in a better way than a class action.
And is it also that there's a distinction between everyone suffering the same damage, essentially, in a class action when everybody suffers the same damage? They all spent $50 on the formula, whereas in an MDL, the disease may be worse for this child than that child, and so there's a different damage that's associated with it. It's not just a set number that we can apply. Is that's also a distinction?
That's exactly right. Class actions are essentially a faceless mass of individuals who all suffered the exact harm. There's no variation. Here, you can have a child who passed away as a result of having this cow's milk formula, or you can have a child who had part of his gut taken out,
right,
or you can have a child who was just treated with antibiotics. So the varying levels of injuries are different, and we try those cases differently, and we work them up differently based on the damages for each individual plaintiff.
Interesting. And is there a separate action associated with saying this is human milk versus, and they're selling cow's milk? I mean, that to me just sounds like fraud.
There's some evidence of fraud, but what we're primarily arguing is what's called failure to warn. What that means is that this company was aware of the fact that there was an increased risk associated with cow's milk formula and neck in premature infants. But what they failed to do is warn mothers and fathers when they were being given this formula in the NICU about that increased risk. So that's one of the arguments there. The next argument is going to be the idea that this product was designed improperly. It's what we call a design defect, meaning that this product was not designed for premature infants. So, and what I want to be absolutely clear on is infant formula is safe for a full-term baby. Cow's milk enzymes, full-term babies can digest that with no problem. Our specific argument is that this infant population of the 37 weeks or before are not equipped internally to digest it. So there's a design defect for that population of infants.
Where can people get more information about this?
So it's something as simple as Googling it, but really what this comes down to is being a smart consumer. You know, what we know from working in the mass torts world and working in this pharmaceutical kind of litigation world is that the government is not always going to tell you the truth. these companies, you cannot rely on them to give you information on it. And we can't rely on the media to tell the right story. That's why I'm glad I'm sitting here talking with you. So it is so important to be a smart consumer. It is so important to do your own research. So there's plenty of information out there that's going to summarize the necrotizing enterocolitis and the facts here. But what you need to do is every time you're using a new product, every time you're introducing a product into your child's life, do the research on it. Look it up.
Yeah, that's tough. That's a tough situation. I mean, because on some level, we're living in an era now where there's like vaccine denial and do your own research and on some level, like it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
Right. I mean, if there's at one point, let's put it this way. If I was going to go do my own research about tobacco, 25, 30, well, let's say 40 years ago, it would probably lead me down the wrong path.
And you know, that's a fair point. But when I say you can't necessarily trust mainstream media to tell this story, I say that because if you look at the marketing practices of the infant formula industry, they are funneling millions of billions of dollars into marketing practices, just like we saw with tobacco.
Right.
So there is this balance of where do I find the right information and how do I get it? But taking the steps to do so are ultimately going to protect you in the long run if the information is available.
How, I just still can't get over, like, how is there not, do you guys ever recruit, let's say, like a state attorney general? Like, I don't know how many, X number of millions of pounds of baby formula has been marketed to premature babies in New York State. Would you ever, like, do lawyers like you go and present this stuff to the state AG and they start an action that, you know, does an overall determination on whether this has happened? And or how does, is there ever, because I know the state AGs were involved in the tobacco settlement. What dynamic, what possibilities exist there?
There's certainly possibilities. And this is especially one case where it is more possible than it is not, because you've got programs called the WIC programs, which is just women, infants, and children. And the WIC program has contracts with these major formula companies where they promise to buy X amount of formula. So ultimately, there is an argument that the attorney generals could pursue this litigation on their behalf. But when you're dealing with litigation involving state entities or attorney generals, it is always proves to be difficult because you're dealing with another layer, and that is the political scheme. Yeah. So is this attorney general ready to take on this massive corporation? And it's always a big push.
I imagine these cases also extend beyond the terms of any given attorney general.
Right, right.
Sarah Papantonio, real pleasure to have you on, and thanks for the information, and appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks. Let me switch this. I'll do that. How's that?
Sounds good.
A little better there. Switch cameras. I switched that one.
One second.
I was able to move that. I think that completes our program. I am finding that I'm much more sensitive to, you know, it's really interesting. I'm more sensitive to the possible implications of, you know, the concerns about drugs on people and doing interviews on the show because of what we've just gone through in this country with the ongoing vaccine denial. And, you know, I don't just lose money at the blackjack table. I also often engage in some political conversations, and I got into one last night at a table with my favorite blackjack dealer in Las Vegas, who I've talked about on this program. I hadn't seen him in 4 or 5 years. The one who taught me at a 6-5 odds table. You've got 21. Dealer showing us a 6. You double down. I know that sounds insane to people, but that's what the odds say. Mm. And anyways, and there's just, you know, got into a political conversation around the table, and the level of suspicion about COVID and the jab, et cetera, is really, really disturbing. And it has more stakes, I think, in an issue when you're talking about a pandemic, right? Because you're talking about public health, broadly speaking, that could implicate everyone in the country, more or less, as opposed to like skepticism and concern about a subset or a cohort of people. But it's interesting. And, you know, you can't really ask people to go do their own research. You can make it available to some people. But
first, we need to teach people how to research and what to sort of look for. And that right. requires like public education and things like
yes,
that.
Yes, I think that's a good point, Matt. I mean, I think that's part of the problem, right? I mean, it's like I'm going to look at the very least, you know, the fact that the NIH is looking into these potential correlations between acetaminophen and autism, and that this is actually something that's being investigated is a good thing, at the very least, there's somebody who is, you know, there are reputable people who are at least investigating the issue.
Which puts the lie to like the main point of emphasis from all the anti-vaxxers, which is like they're too afraid or they're covering something up.
Right, right. But it's interesting, like my increased sensitivity that I don't know I would have had 4 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it was there a little bit because like the, you know, Wakefield autism study, you know, was a sort of precursor to the full-blown anti-vax, you know, mass movement. We've
right,
seen.
Right. I mean, but, you know, and it took a couple of years before that was debunked, right? And, but there was also, and I remember doing an interview in 2004, Janine and I, with, I can't for the life of me remember who it was. I think it was a journalist who, you know, was basically saying, we're going to see if thimerosal, which is a suspect in this, is causing this rise in autism in 2 or 3 years. And that the 2 or 3 years passed and you did not see any change in the rate of autism. And so, you know, at the time I felt like that was the responsible approach to take, particularly at a time, I think, like, it's much easier to do that at a time where people have the opportunity to have the thimerosal free version, you know. And I think having, you know, being moderate with what you're taking during pregnancy is a fair burden, you know, because you don't want to be put in the position where you're making mothers or pregnant people feel that they're doing something wrong, or they're, you know, because they're dealing with pain or whatnot. And so I think, like, you know, being moderate with anything is, I think, appropriate.
Right. Well, it's just, I mean, it's difficult for people to do their own research, as Matt was saying, because we have very little healthcare literacy in this country. And the only times people feel empowered to take over their health is through consumption and as consumers. And so that's why it's important to just be very specific about the products being consumed and not to put the onus on people, because we just have no education in this country, since our whole healthcare system is for profit and there's just no mass understanding because we don't have socialized healthcare.
Let's do some sound. There's a couple of things I wanted to cover.
Okay.
As we sort of complete the I guess the tort litigation part of our program, it turned out okay in the end. I mean, that's the thing. It's like I never know who I'm going to get. I talk to like 10 people and I get 8 yeses and then like 3 show up. That's basically what happens. But what are you going to do? All right. We started the program, or we covered this, I guess, with Farron earlier, an exchange between a debate between Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson, one of the dumbest individuals in the Senate, I have to say. And it was a very innocuous last question to the debate, where the debate moderators had said, we travel across Wisconsin. People don't like the rancor and the fighting and the meanness between the candidates. Can you tell us something that you admire about each other? And Mandela Barnes says, well, I admire the fact he's a family man. I think that's admirable. And he takes care of his family. And that's a good thing. And then Ron Johnson said, yeah, Mandela's a family guy, but also hates America. And that was basically what he said. And what I found really fascinating was, A, I think that actually hurts Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, just based upon what I know about Wisconsin. I'm not going to say it's, you know, election changing, but that's not the way you want to end that debate if you're Ron Johnson, as far as I can tell.
Well, he got booed, so.
He got booed, and, like, even
that'll be like the number one news story. Like, that's the number one takeaway people will take from a debate like that, is he's uncouth.
Uncouth and mean and rancor. Do you want to vote for more rancor? I mean, frankly, I think people who turned against Trump, that's what they, why they turned against him.
100%.
And, but Mandela Barnes, I think, was a little bit more sneaky in his reply than you might think at first.
This I overlooked this entirely.
This came from earlier in the debate, and maybe I'm just projecting, but I don't know. Well, play this clip.
...surrounding Lieutenant Governor Barnes' diploma. But we do know he got a degree in communications specializing in performance. So he's a performer. He's an actor. And I don't know if he's just delivering lines somebody wrote for him or that he's making this stuff up on his own.
Pause it for 1 second. I just want to remind people, do you remember what the big criticism of Obama was in the 2008 election? He's just reading from a teleprompter.
Mm. All right.
There is a little bit of coding in there. This guy's not so smart. He can just play one on TV.
Mm.
Go back.
In performance. So he's a performer. He's an actor. And I don't know if he's just delivering lines somebody wrote for him or that he's making this stuff up on his own. But falsehoods just seem to roll up his tongue. So I suggest anybody watching this debate or the campaign take anything Mr. Barnes says with a huge grain of salt.
Well, go ahead. I would absolutely like to respond to that. Because... well,
go ahead.
Well, because the reality is the senator is going to try to run and distract from his record. He can't run from the fact that when there was an opportunity for him to provide support for public safety initiatives, he walked away. The American Rescue Plan allowed our administration to invest $100 million in the law enforcement, public safety, and crime prevention initiatives. Ron Johnson voted against it because he would rather play politics. And look, the biggest achievement in business was Ron Johnson saying, I do. He married into his business. Ooh. He didn't start that from the ground up.
Ooh. All right.
And you take that where he's basically like, it's almost as if he used the admiration a moment of his answer later in the debate as a callback he takes care of his family. I admire that. Now, if you go back earlier and what I said, you realize, like, really, his family took care of him.
Yeah, family man.
Yeah, family man. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting on that, but that was a pretty...
I mean, if that's the case, that's pretty smart politics. I'm sure they had that lined up, too, because this seems to be something that in these Senate races, the debates, they ask this all the time. Like, people are so sick of the division. Say something nice about the other. I remember they did that with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as well. But oh, yeah. I wish I remembered what he said there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But so yeah, I would not
like
be...
Yeah, that's like that case. Like, what's your greatest weakness?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a total
a
job
you can
interview.
Predict. Yeah.
BS question. But I wouldn't be shocked, honestly, if he did want to make that connection. So then people... Google Ron Johnson family, and then that comes up.
Who knows? But that is a race that I think is going to be tough for Mandela Barnes. You know, but who knows? Let's put it this way: if Mandela Barnes wins that race, I think I would imagine that it's a very, very good chance the Democrats will have at least 52 senators in 2023. If not, I think there's still a pretty good chance of the Democrats holding the Senate, but we shall see.
And it looks like, unfortunately, some of the opposition research about, you know, Barnes's statements on, like, you know, defunding the police or crime or things like that have seemingly had some salience in the polls. But I just feel like with every Wisconsin election, like, I believe that will be the same way with Tony Evers and the Republican candidate Tim Michaels. I just think both of those races are going to be essentially splitting hairs when it comes to it on November. Just because every big Wisconsin election seemingly is just completely divided down the middle.
Yeah, right.
I
do think this is maybe he has a better chance than Tim Ryan in Ohio, just based on the redness of the state.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, those are the two opportunities.
He did really well in this debate, though, I feel like.
Yes.
I think
who's that? Tim Ryan did?
Ryan did, but I also think Barnes did here as
well.
Barnes
did,
I think, a very good job.
Barnes is a good candidate.
And we should say the polling shows Tim Ryan closer to J.D. Vance than Barnes to Johnson.
Which I don't think any of us really anticipated coming into, you know, the fall.
But Tim Ryan has just such a history in that state and has built up a lot of equity with people, and has name recognition.
He also has a model for how you win as a Democrat in that state, and it's Sherrod Brown. Now, I don't Tim Ryan is not as progressive as Sherrod Brown, but it's one of those states where you can be very pro labor and address the concerns of what's happened in that state in terms of, like, industry leaving. And so he's got that model there, and he seems to be sort of using it. So I guess we'll see. What else should we cover here, Emma?
I guess we could talk, well, we covered both of those debates as well. We could cover this Tudor Dixon Gretchen Whitmer debate, since it seems like we're in debate season, if you'd like.
Yeah, let's do that. Now, I think Whitmer, it when people ask me, well, before we get to the clip, I got to tell this story about the, I was at this, you know, this blackjack table, and I told them, you know, that, what do you do for a living? I do this, I do that. And I'm like, well, I talk about politics. You know, and he always hesitant to do that because it's well, because I can't, once I start going, I can't shut up about it. And
also, you never kind of know what reaction you're going to get.
Oh,
once
no,
you say
I knew what reaction I was going to get.
Okay.
I
mean, it was the crowd you could kind of read.
Yeah, I mean, you know, generally, when you go to any type of, like, normie situation in huge swaths of this country, most of the people I talk to are I'm going to be the to the left of. That's just the reality of it. But one of these guys goes, do you think it's Joe Biden in the White House? And I'm like, sort of, yeah, I sort of do. And he like pulls up on his phone. He's like, shows me a picture of like Joe Biden in, I don't know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Joe Biden now.
Oh, he goes, my God.
Do you really think these are the same people?
Oh, my God. And it's like the Paul McCartney theory.
I'm like, yeah, I said to him, I said, I got to be honest with you. This is not politics.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is not politics. Like, you can go online and see, like, you're never going to believe who, you know, what the actor from Silver Spoons looks like today, you know, or, you know, this is this woman then, and look at the
this is like
plastic surgery.
Yeah. Page six, like top 10 botched facelifts. It's exactly. Just like Biden got a facelift. It's super obvious. His face is tight. His eyes are tighter. That's what facelifts look like. Yeah.
I said he got a facelift. I mean, you can see the surgery, like you can see the lines behind his ear. And he goes, in one picture, his earlobes are like this, in one picture like that. And I said, look, I said, let's just assume that you're right. They're not the same people. Will you explain to me why they, whoever they are, said, let's get rid of the real Biden. Let's go to the nursing home, find someone who isn't really that mobile. Maybe not that you know, completely sort of fluid in when he speaks and is, you know, looking a little furtive at times. Let's replace him with that guy. Like, wow. Isn't the whole point of putting in somebody else to sort of
you
do
don't
some
get
type
it.
Of upgrade?
That's because the robot's malfunctioning, not because the person is like the guy who's acting as Biden is not, the signals are getting crossed. So that's why he's stuttering or acting.
I mean, this is the old type of false empowerment where you have the entire media being like, Fetterman, we were really actually asking, can he do the office? And like, it's just not really the questions that should be asked.
It's right. Just nuts what passes for politics. And then, you know, I did. And folks, when you find yourself in this type of situation, you got to be very I mean, the way I do it is like, I try and really maintain civility and get inside the circle of trust and this and that. And I'm talking to another guy at the table who's like, look, I don't Republican, Democrat. I just look at math and I want what's best for the most amount of people. And I'm like, that's more or less what my politics are. And then of course they don't like taxation though. And this is always fun. And I don't think this is going to come as a surprise to anybody, but I have an image of, and you can find this anywhere online, of the historical tax rates, top marginal tax rates in the country, like most people. But when you tell people that for 15 to 20 years, the top marginal tax rate in this country took 90 cents out of every dollar over approximately $450,000, what would be $3 million today, 90 cents out of it every dollar during the greatest expansion of the middle class in this country's history. Their heads explode. And even if you are a libertarian who's like, well, but that's not the effective tax rate. The effective tax rate was 45%, which of course is still light years beyond what we have as an effective tax rate in this country. And there's some dispute as to whether it was 45%, 55%, 60%. It doesn't matter. And then it just moved to, well, that's slavery.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, Not really, no. And the argument I had too is like, well, that's not right. That's not the Constitution. Constitution says treat everybody equally. I'm like, yes, everybody is treated equally. Everybody who makes over $450,000, you know, $3 million in today's, will get the same tax rate. I mean, the idea that we treat everybody equally, that's like saying like, How come this guy gets to be a senior in high school, but that guy has to be in elementary school? Well, that guy's 17 and this guy's, you know, 9. Well, don't we treat everybody the same? No, it doesn't work that way. Anyways, Whitmer.
Yes.
Set up this clip because I think it's important because I think Whitmer is probably, who knows if Joe Biden's going to run again, but if he doesn't, Whitmer is going to be in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, classic case of not necessarily my politics, but she's doing a good job in Michigan in what I think is, you know, could be difficult conditions for a Democrat.
Yeah, and she's running against, or her opponent is this extremist, Tudor Dixon, who at the closing of this debate tries to contrast her stances with that of Whitmer and ends it on fear-mongering about what else trans kids.
The governor would like to forget you to forget how hard the last 4 years have been with Gretchen Whitmer. She's shown us who she is. She stood on this very stage and said she wouldn't raise taxes. And she tried and tried and tried again to raise your taxes over and over. She also said that she cares about women, but she would gladly put little boys in your daughter's locker room. She also said she cares about parents, but she hasn't stood for parents who have said, why do we have adults whispering sex and gender into the ears of our little kids? This governor's policies are radical, dangerous, and destructive. Crime is up. Jobs are down, schools are worse, and the roads didn't get fixed. That's what happens when you hire a radical career politician. You go in the wrong direction. Lansing needs common sense. We need to make sure we stop strangling our businesses and we help them to create jobs, we help them to increase salaries, and we help them to be prosperous. We need to tell our parents, we've got your back. We want you to have the final decision on what's happening in your child's education. And we need to make sure that cops, we hire more cops, and they know we have their back, and we're going to get out of their way and let them do their job. But most of all, I want to make sure that we put money back into the pockets of our middle-class families.
She's got a lot of
backs. We need common sense. And when you lack it, that's all you can see. I hope to earn your vote and bring Michigan back to a family-friendly Michigan on November 8th.
Pause it for 1 second.
That's the end, yeah.
Is that me, or, like, why so many backs?
I don't know.
All these backs are being stabbed. She needs to protect them. I always find it really remarkable with candidates like her, especially this cycle in debates, where the messaging seems so dissonant between, like, Gretchen Whitmer wants to sneak into a kid's bathroom and tell her that she's a boy, and then also being like, I'm the common sense middle-class whisperer. I have all of the solutions to get us back on track and return us to normalcy. Contrasting that with like, basically saying that Gretchen Whitmer is a lizard person.
I mean, she's essentially alluding to, with that comment about putting boys in girls' locker rooms, that it's a sexual violence threat.
And whispering into your child's ear about sexuality.
Right. She's basically saying that trans kids, when they are in the locker room with with cis children of their same gender identity, that they are a potential rape threat. I mean, that is just, like, really, really gross stuff. Also, of course, you know, what she's been running on is a ban on trans athletes in girls and women's sports. You know, the kind of stuff, the kitchen table issues that parents care about.
I mean, this is sort of fascinating when you think about, like, this is the closing argument, is, you know, that dominated by the trans issue. It just shows how sort of, like, bereft. And this is a governor's race. Really, this is a governor's race where, like, these people are actually, like, they actually do stuff, as opposed to, you know, senators who pass laws. Their whole job is about execution. Their whole job is about policy. And this is what the Republican, to the extent that there's a national Republican agenda, it is this notion that trans kids are, you know, or like the trans ideology is taking over the country. It's just, I mean, I get, I don't know. I still am sort of just sort of blown away from this, by this. I mean, you think of like the challenges facing this country. You know, I understand that they're not up there saying, you know, we're going to protect the right of women to choose. And I also understand they're not up there because they realize how deeply, deeply unpopular it is for them to say we're going to ban abortions as a closing argument because they don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
But this is the best you can come up with?
And also, I think we saw this with the Emma when we played the John Stewart clip with Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, is the idea that like this parents' rights argument is just so unbelievably disingenuous, because the implication, as always, and it's, I think it's obvious to say, but it's parents' rights to do what Tudor Dixon wants the parents to do.
Right.
It's the parents' rights to support only essentially cisgender heterosexual children. It's not a parent's right if they have a trans kid or a non-binary kid or a queer kid to actually help them obtain care or help them essentially not, you know, succumb to crippling depression by way of these policies.
Yeah, have the class understand them.
Right. It's not the parents have the rights to support their kid no matter what. It's parents have the right to support their kid as long as Leslie Rutledge or Tudor Dixon thinks it's appropriate for you to do so.
Right.
Let's play this clip of Charlie Kirk. You know,
yeah.
I had mentioned earlier in the program that it seemed like Alex Jones had shifted after the Texas verdict, $53 some odd million, but capped under Texas law. I'm not sure what the cap was, that he was going to abandon like a legal strategy to fight this and basically use the legal fight that he was in to raise more cash. And this is just going to be, you know, it's like a business. I've got some fixed costs in the form of defamation awards, and I'm going to use that and parlay that into making some money. I mean, this is, you know, this is a common sort of like feature of these type of programs. And it sort of feels like Charlie Kirk is a little bit bummed. He can't get a piece of that pie. So here's his attempt.
It's not about whether you like Alex Jones. It is completely irrelevant. What is relevant is, do you think that the law industrial complex, in collusion with the media, can work in harmony to completely obliterate somebody financially for saying something wrong and then apologize?
Pause it for 1 second. Did he coin this law industrial media complex?
I've never heard the limp.
it's like the law industrial medical media, plumbing, like you could just include
electrical.
Everything.
Right.
Yeah. Complex.
This is why Charlie Kirk was speaking out on behalf of Amber Heard in the Johnny Depp trial. Right. He's just very much against the idea of defamation as a concept.
That's actually a really good point. Like, all these people were absolutely cheering on Johnny Depp. They're like, take everything from that B word.
Yeah. I mean, they used it for clicks because it was fundamentally like the media circus around it was a misogynistic one. And that was the impulse that it was feeding into. And I'm sure that all of his colleagues, if not him specifically, were on Johnny Depp's side, and now suddenly they're against defamation.
All right.
You know, trials.
Let's keep going.
Complex, in collusion with the media, can work in harmony to completely obliterate somebody financially for saying something wrong and then therefore apologizing afterwards. Oh, so they're going to go for Mike Lindell next. Or are they going to go for Steve Bannon? Are they going to go for this program? Are they going to go for Tucker Carlson? The New York Times says this now holds lessons. They are running. This is practice for them. This is a spring football game. This is spring training. This is double-A baseball for them before they get to the majors. Alex Jones is not the destination. Alex Jones is just getting them refined to be able to do what they actually want.
Hell yeah.
I mean, it's a defamation case. It's a defamation case. These have gone on many, many times. In fact, wasn't there something called Gawker? Matt, do you remember what happened to Gawker?
I believe it was sued out of existence by Peter Thiel backing a lawsuit by Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
For political reasons, because Peter Thiel didn't like the way they covered it.
Not that they had any connections, right.
What was Hulk Hogan charging them with?
They published a sex tape of his.
And him saying the N-word.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's also stuff like that.
Even though both revelations of those things were previously reported on.
And he was claiming it was defamatory.
Mm-hmm. Yes, defamation.
Well, Charlie was still not in college at that time. It's fascinating. I honestly think that Alex Jones has earned the opportunity to spend his entire life either paying off that $1 billion or trying to avoid paying off that $1 billion.
Yeah. Also, like, Charlie includes that lie about him being so apologetic and stuff like that. But why should that matter? Like, it's a lie, but why do you feel the need to include it? Because it shades the conclusion people might take, because he's actually not apologetic at all about that.
And I'm also curious, like, the complexity he was talking about, this is a jury award.
Like, yeah,
They're spending too much time even analyzing how ridiculous this is. But it is ridiculous.
If Alex Jones was apologetic, what was he apologizing for then? Because I thought this was all led by the limp dick industrial complex or whatever that was. So, I mean, you know, it can't be apologetic if he didn't do anything wrong, right?
Should we do one more clip?
Yeah, the thing about Candace Owens,
I think we should play that in the Shapiro clip. I'd love to play both.
Yeah, sure.
Right, let's do it.
So this is Candace Owens speaking at a Turning Points USA event, speaking of Charlie Kirk, saying that there's nothing worse right now than being a straight white male in American society. This is her whole shtick. But then she goes a little bit further, using her cachet, or so she feels, to drive this point home.
We've now somehow gotten into this society where people are pretending what we're doing is equality, and it's not. If we have ever achieved equality in this country, then you wouldn't blink if anybody says Asian lives matters, no one blinks. Black lives matter, no one blinks. But white lives matter, they fell apart, right? They fell apart because they actually, and I will stand by this as much as I possibly can, and I will be the loudest voice. The actually worst thing to be in this society, if one thing I would not want to be, is a straight white male. Yep. For some reason, that's considered problematic, right? You have to be something. So people lie. They're lying on college applications. They're like, okay, I'm white, but I'm also trans. And you're like, what? Why are you pretending? It's because, I don't want people to think I'm too normal, right? Yeah. And people, you know, they're just trying to find something that makes them not white, right? And it's really staggering to think that once upon a time, that is exactly what the experience was for a Black American, that being a Black American was so problematic that you weren't going to be allowed into the room. Now you have the exact same thing happening reverse, and you have liberals trying to convince you that that's equality. Yeah. It's not. All lives matter, and that's including white lives matter, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the symmetry between what slaves went through and what I go through on a day-to-day basis, like, I'm glad Candace is safe.
And Matt, you say this every time, like at the water cooler, you're like, can you, Emma, just kind of figure out a way for me to not consider myself as white or as straight as I am? Like, is there anything in my personality or appearance where I could hang my hat on that? I hear you say this every day.
I say check your privilege as well, because you don't know how hard the last couple of years have been.
Sorry.
You're right.
As the straight white men in this office, I think you need to maybe tone it down a little bit.
I'm sorry. I really should know my place.
This is why I'm so obsessed with, you know, the antebellum South is because I basically see myself in those fields.
Yeah, and Frederick Douglass, you know. Like.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, you know what I got to say? what is sort of fascinating is that she almost, like, she has to be very careful, right? Because she's almost stumbling upon the acknowledging the incredible oppression that you go through and being trans in this country, right? Like she almost acknowledges the fact that, you know, but instead it's just like, I can't be seen as normal. But like, there's a little bit of dilemma that they have when they're trying to make this, because she says she wouldn't want to be a white guy in today's society. And I believe that because there's already a Charlie Kirk in that organization and they need a Candace Owens.
Mm.
But the reason she says is because you're considered too normal. And not like that really isn't like what she's really trying to say. She's trying to say like they are lacking privilege. And she says, and so I want to, you know, pretend that I'm trans because those are people who have been historically oppressed and they're theoretically going to get an advantage for it. But it's a weird sort of dance where she has to both acknowledge and disavow simultaneously, as if like in the past, like, you know, 6 months, it's become really much easier for trans kids, let's say, to exist in our society. In some areas it has, but in the vast majority, no. In fact, in Michigan, they're, you know, lawmakers are trying to criminalize parents providing any type of trans affirming care. But Matt, I'm sorry. I'm sorry they're doing this to you. As a Jew, I don't go through any of the white.
Yeah, you're lucky. I mean, I could
pass as not white.
You're all lucky. There's a Martin Amis, his first novel, The Rachel Papers. It starts with a line like, I'm the unfortunate product of an unbroken home. And because he doesn't have anything to sort of romanticize
right.
his teenage life.
are we going to do...
Well, yeah. Speaking of your the whole Jewish thing that about you, Sam. Yes. speaking of your Judaism, Ben Shapiro's address, Candace Owens' remarks, where she basically defended Kanye West, tweeting that he wanted to go quote DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. She spent her entire segment on it, asking a bunch of questions about what he was intending, giving him the most generous, I guess, interpretation possible, saying that you'd have to be disingenuous to assume that he was being anti-Semitic. Right. A lot of other just nonsense. And Shapiro came out with like really lukewarm critique initially of Kanye West via a tweet. He's increasingly been feeling the heat and has gotten a bit more critical. And now he speaks out about Candace Owens' commentary specifically, since they are both in the Daily Wire fam.
Candace and I disagree about a wide variety of topics. One of the features, not the bugs, of Daily Wire Plus is the fact that we openly disagree about all of this stuff. I share my opinions about what I think Candace is saying. She shares her opinions about what she thinks that I'm saying. We battle it out. It's one of the things that you get at Daily Wire Plus, is the fact that there is a wide variety of opinions. Listen, on a personal level, I get Candace defending her friend. She's very close with Kanye West. I get it. I don't think that her defense of Kanye is correct or convincing. I think that the real answer to the Kanye West of it is Kanye is a bipolar human being. I mean, he's made this very clear. I talked about this on the show. And bipolar people tend to say extraordinarily bizarre things and ugly things. And again, that doesn't excuse the bizarreness or the ugliness of the actual remarks, which, as I will say once again for the 1,000th time, are in fact anti-Semitic. But there's a difference between somebody cohesively saying what Kanye West said and Kanye West saying things in broken grammar in the midst of what appears to be a bizarre period of his life in which he is presenting Adidas executives with porn in front of their face. And I'm not going to treat that the same as Ilhan Omar saying openly anti-Semitic stuff as an elected congressperson in the United States of America. So
okay, interesting. So I just have a quick question for Ben Shapiro here. It's amazing that his, well, I guess more of it's just more of an observation. It's amazing how his empathy can extend to Kanye West, who is clearly, yes, he's bipolar, and perhaps he has some sort of episode happening right now that would make sense. But not for, say, Ilhan Omar, who was in a refugee camp, and how that might inform her perspective on Palestinian apartheid, or the fact that Rashida Tlaib still has family within Palestine, and that might inform her perspective on Israeli apartheid. Now he has empathy for somebody who's actually tweeted something anti-Semitic, but the empathy does not extend for, like, real-life human experiences for people who might have a more humanitarian perspective towards Palestinians.
Of course, because the reason why he brings up Ilhan Omar is because her criticism, in fact, was not only not anti-Semitic, it was incredibly legitimate about and so uncontroversial that even Thomas Friedman had said something almost identical years earlier. But what I find interesting is, okay, if you're going to say that the reason why you're not excusing, but you're explaining Kanye West things because he's bipolar and he's saying things that are bizarre and inappropriate, then isn't there some critique that you might want to reserve also for Candace Owens, for Tucker Carlson, and for any other of your right-wing buddies who are exploiting what you say is clear mental illness to attempt to score political points? Like, if you're going to acknowledge the fact that the guy is going out and he is basically, there's no one around him who is willing to basically provide him the help that he clearly needs, you're saying he's going through some type of psychological episode. Well, how about holding to account those people around him who are basically taking his psychological episode and waving it around as some type of club? I mean, that's the thing, is he wants it one way, but he won't accept the implications of the way that he wants it.
Right.
To cover for Candace Owens. That's what I find fascinating. Well, I'm going to excuse his anti-Semitism, or just at the very least explain it because he's having an episode. But I'm not going to talk about the people who are basically wielding him around to make some, frankly, somewhat of a racist point. And it, you know, because the sort of racist point that he's making, well, that's legit, but the anti-Semitic one that's coming around is you're sort of wielding this person who's going through a psychological episode. That's illegitimate. That's what's really going on here.
Yeah, right. That's a great point. Like, in his the anti-Semitism is a function of his mental episode, but the White Lives Matter stuff we agree with. So, I mean, we're just going to totally ignore that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we can keep going.
Executives with porn in front of their face. And I'm not going to treat that the same as Ilhan Omar saying openly anti-Semitic stuff as an elected congressperson in the United States of America. So, when it comes to Candace, I mean, look, am I still friends? Of course I'm friendly with Candace. Am I friendly with Tucker Carlson? I mean, Tucker cut a segment from his interview with Kanye, in which Kanye said a bunch of anti-Semitic stuff. Listen, am I friends with Joe Rogan? Joe Rogan had on Roger Waters the other day. Roger Waters is a ridiculous anti-Semitic jerk. I mean, like, wide varieties of disagreement happen in this space. Bottom line is, when it comes to Kanye's remarks, undoubtedly anti-Semitic remarks. When it comes to Candace's defense of those remarks, I think Candace is dead wrong on what she said. While respecting her relationship with Kanye, she knows Kanye better than I do, she knows his motive. Okay, whatever. All of that I'm sure is true, and I will take that for granted. What she said about Kanye, I radically disagree with. I think that she is dead wrong. I think that it betrays a lack of understanding about anti-Semitism and the scope of anti-Semitism. Mm. But we're allowed to have those disagreements. That's the way this works.
Mm. Boy, oh boy. Ben's not doing a very good job around the commissary.
Yeah,
Candace Owens over there teaching Candace about anti-Semitism. You'd think if anybody would know, it would be those people on, you know, at the commissary over in his what's the name of his thing? Right,
the Daily Wire.
Daily Wire Plus.
Daily Wire Plus. Hmm.
Well.
You hate to see it. You hate to see that type of disagreement.
Yeah, so Ben Shapiro says, Candace Owens is too loyal to her friends to be honest and lacks understanding about anti-Semitism. Print headline.
But let's also be clear, just to sum up, too, he's saying when you are having a mental episode and say stuff that is anti-Semitic, it's anti-Semitic. When you are having a mental episode and say stuff that is racist or denying of racism, you're right.
Right.
That's basically what he's saying.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, let's read a couple of IMs and then wrap this up.
All right.
Thames Darwin, two things about the Shapiro-Owens thing. First, Shapiro has spoken in the past about how his grandfather was bipolar, had hospitalization, so it's giving him some cover here. Second, I predict that he cuts Owen loose in the coming weeks, months. Remember how he distanced himself in stages from Sting, Steve King, and Breitbart. Yeah, I doubt it.
Candace is too hot of a commodity right now.
Yes, exactly. Really cool. Two quick points. Camp Lejeune water crisis. Got a true story. Maybe I'll call in Monday, 917 area code. PFAS headline news in The Garden yesterday. Lastly, Yomi Shofar, today's my birthday. I'm sorry. Wait, that was from yesterday. Sorry. Indie Pedal, audio sounds fantastic today. Good job, crew. Yeah, good job, guys.
Yeah.
Frozen Farts, is the Fun Half link somewhere else in the app now? I haven't seen it in days. Well, we didn't do a Fun Half yesterday.
Yeah.
And we're just doing an open. But you know what we should do? When we do one show, we should post it twice. One in the members feed, one in the free feed, okay?
Okay.
Slappy Tubbs, Minnesota Nice, if it does exist, does not leak into Wisconsin like cultural diarrhea. Ron Johnson played to his crowd, and his negative comments only serves to energize his base. People moaned at the debate, but at least in western Wisconsin, households cheered. I have no doubt. I have no doubt, but the game that they play is, how do I get my people to cheer and not turn off other people? And I'm convinced that, yes, that will cheer, that will turn off other people. In not, I'm not talking tons, but some. Probably not enough, but bull prog. You know what they say, it takes time to clean up the poo-poo. Militant apathy. Y'all still changed to world. Bobby Kennedy lost his...
Talking about Air America, y'all still changed the world.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Bobby Kennedy lost his mind about vaccines. I hope this turns out better. Yeah, I... Gregory from Oklahoma. Hey, y'all, I'm Gregory Hardin, running state representative in Oklahoma. Please donate to my campaign. I need to raise $20,000 before the date of the election on November 8th. I need not to just make sure my campaign is successful, that I maximize turnout for Democratic candidates up ballot in Oklahoma. Go to gregory4hd26.com, gregory4hd26.com to donate or check out the campaign merch shop for shirts, pens, and pencils. Thank you for everyone who's been supporting my campaign. It means a lot. Yeah, check it out. Gregory sent us some t-shirts. They were awesome.
Yeah, I wear mine all the time. I love it.
J-Man Raps, happy Friday, gang. Just want to shout out Matt from last week on Russia-Ukraine, calling people Russian assets, etc. Just because we don't want our government's funding wars is absurd, but some leftists just buy into the thinking of white supremacist empire. Also, it's a total right-wing attack. Anyway, left is best. Sammy Silver Fox. Sam, can you ask the guest about the average age? Oh, I did that. I saw that. Is anyone going to do a live stream of the Warnock-Walker debate tonight? My plan is to do so.
Ooh,
fine.
What time is it on? Does anybody know?
It's at 7 p.m. Eastern.
So 4 p.m. out here. Oh, shit. I got to move. All right. Three more, and then we'll be out of here. I'm going to try. Look on the YouTube. I'm going to try and do it. Jay Tingle. Pretty slick that Sam and Pap list the on-air town of Air American, managed to omit Mark Maron. Oh, yeah, whatever. and now Sam's taking a pot shot at Ricky Schroeder. Got to say, being not white has paid huge benefits in Candace Owens' career, benefits that would not have been available to a similarly positioned white woman. Yeah. I think that's probably true. She has made the most of it. And the final IM of the day. Carly Scherer, thanks for tackling this anti-trans hysteria. As a person who went through childhood being trans, but not having the information to understand what I was going through, I can't thank you enough for bringing the rights nonsense to the spotlight. It's that kind of crap that made my life more difficult than it needed to be. Solidarity forever. Appreciate that.
Appreciate it.
All right, folks. Matt, Bradley, Emma, great job this week. I will be blessedly back in studio on Monday, ensconced in the warm embrace of the Majority Report headquarters. Until then, bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bar. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you?